It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin about the big budget fight that went on today. We're going to be talking about House Bill 916 that went down in defeat. We're going to be talking about a whole bunch of stuff with him, what's going on here in Harrisburg and what attacks will be coming in the coming days, because the Republicans, you know, House Bill 916 going down today, a big thing. This really a phenomenal thing. And we're going to talk about that later. Also in the program, we'll talk to Jason Leopold from Truth Out about his piece on the VA. And again, going back to what I said at the very beginning when Bush got us into Afghanistan and then Iraq, my hope was is that we didn't treat this generation of soldiers the way we had the last. And this new Ninth Circuit decision basically lays out my every fear, that we have treated these men and women poorly and that something needs to be done. So we'll talk to Jason about his piece and the decision as well. Also, Abe Amoros, legislative director of the Laborers International Union, LIUNA, going to be here talking about the comp bill, the unemployment bill, all those threshold bills that are out there to make sure that Republicans have their bit of work out there for their brother-in-laws and their son-in-laws and all those people who need jobs, good patronage jobs, taking us back a century or so. You know, back to the good old days, before the 20th century, when politicians had that kind of power, where, you know, government work was based on nepotism, based on patronage. The good old days, you know. That's where we want to be. In the third hour, Robert Craig from Citizens Action United. Citizens Action Wisconsin is going to be here talking about the 100 days since the awakening in Wisconsin. And that ought to be interesting. Also, the recalls, all the stuff that's going on since the Walker attacks began. And if you remember, Robert Craig was the guy who was the first person to say, hey, Walker is threatening to use the National Guard against us. Is no one worried about this? So I give him credit for that. I don't know if he'll take it or not, but I give it to him. Because the reality is it's what happened. Walker threatened to use the National Guard to come in and replace all those people to take over, very, very, militaristic, if you will. Fortunately, the folks of Wisconsin rose up and battled that back. Got some fighting to do yet. There's some recalls out there, and that's going to be a good thing. I don't know if you saw this, Harold Camping, the guy who said last weekend was going to be the end of the world. Evidently, he went back, did some recalculations. October 21st, that's going to be the revised end of the world. We just rescheduled it a couple months. A little math. Forgot to carry the one and subtract the four. So, right there, everything's going to be good. End of the world. Mark it on your calendars. October 21st. So for those of you who didn't sell off all your stuff and do all the crazy things you wanted to do before you die, you still got a couple of months, October 21st. So good for you. But like I said, you know, House Bill 916 down in flames. I don't know that we can claim total victory yet, but it looks that his bill, the employer-written unemployment bill, down in flames. 32 Republicans voted against it, and all the Democrats. Honestly, I thought it was the end of the world today. Finally, something all of the Democrats agreed on. I guess what it's as bad as that bill was, that's how you get people to come together. This bill was that bad. But here's the thing. By no means does this mean the attacks are going to stop. It just means that some of your representatives were actually listening to you. And that's why I say, you know what? We need to keep it up. We need to keep the pressure on. And if you watch some of the speeches today that they gave over the budget, it's absolutely amazing at how the right keeps right on with their message. They are right online. And you've got these millionaires who, you know, they think they want you to believe they're one of you. And I look at this Congressman Paul Gosar from Arizona, one of the T-Twizzler guys. Here's a guy worth $2 million, has a salary of about $174,000 a year, telling, you know, people in his district, well, you know, I'm not wealthy. I ain't wealthy. I live just like the rest of you folks. Just like the guy not too long ago said, oh, I can't live on $174,000. You know, I've got a minivan and kids, and they're not like us. The median income in Gosar's district, $32,000 a year. Yet he's not wealthy. And what I find interesting is they want to try and identify with average everyday working people, especially the Republicans, because they want you to think that all of the things that they throw out there, all of the divisive, all of the nonsensical, all of the ridiculous issues that they keep throwing out there, somehow that they believe in, when it's really all about the money. It's about the tax cuts for the big businesses. It's about taking away unemployment benefits from people. It's about making workers' comp harder to navigate. It's about all of the things that businesses want that they cover in all of this other distraction. And I look at one of the speeches today. I was listening to Mike Terzai. And, you know, he's going on and on how, you know, the people in his family work hard, and, you know, such and such is a cop and such a school teacher, and they work hard, and they're hard, and they work hard, and they work hard, and we've worked hard, and it's this whole, you know, we've worked hard thing. And, okay, I get it. You like the word hard. I'm not quite sure why, but because not what you're doing is hard work. But he said something that really caught my attention. And I just want to play it. Here.
What tax do you want to increase? Who are you taking the money from?
And that was kind of the crux of his speech. And what tax do I want to increase? Well, I think I've said the drillers, the Delaware loophole, smokeless tobacco, a whole number of things that we've talked about over the years. And who do I want to take the money from? Well, not children and granny. I'm not going to steal food out of the mouths of kids, and I'm not kicking granny to the curb, to answer your two questions. But the Republicans don't want to hear any of that. They've got this blinded vision of where they want to go with things, and this belief that somehow we're all sharing this sacrifice, when in reality they're not. And nothing really points that out more than Eric Cantor this morning, or yesterday, when he said that any bill that Congress passes to help fund the recovery and help the victims of the tornado in Missouri is going to have to come from somewhere else. We're going to have to cut spending somewhere to pay for those folks. That now this is, we're going to have to steal from someone else, make someone else's condition worse to help people who are suffering right now. A very, very short-sighted view. Now look, as bad as Tom DeLay was, and he was bad, he understood that you don't do that during the time of an emergency. When Hurricane Katrina happened, they did put money into it. Granted, the money was poorly spent, it was poorly overseen, it was poorly administered, and it was just plain, well, like you would expect a Republican-run operation to go. A lot of profits, a lot of handouts, a lot of backslapping, a lot of patronage, all that stuff, not much actual work. And that's what happened. You know, like I use the example of the trash all the time. They paid someone $47 a ton to move the trash, and by the time they back scratched and backroom dealed and handed out and patronized and did all this, the guy who actually moved the trash did it for $3 per ton. So what you had is you had $44 worth of that money going to people who did nothing. You know, a good business friendly way of doing things. But again, you know, you've got Cantor out there saying, well, you know, if we're going to help them, we're not going to borrow it. We're going to cut it from somewhere else. So basically, not only are they holding the country hostage over the debt ceiling, they're now holding the people of Missouri hostage for more cuts somewhere else. I mean, are you not getting this? Does this not infuriate you? I got to wonder what the folks in Missouri are thinking. And I look at this whole budget argument both on the state level and on the national level, and it's Republicans holding people hostage. And I like what State Rep Lawrence Curry said here in Pennsylvania, that their spending plan is tantamount to human sacrifice. I like that. I think it's right on, because you know they cut a whole bunch of money for, you know, for very specific programs like hemophiliacs. They cut a bunch of that, and you know, like this guy said, he's afraid that the loss of the access for the centers that the money is going to cut for hemophiliacs is going to force them to see care providers who may not be versed in bleeding disorders, and these people may die. But, you know, facts be damned. We've got an agenda to cover, and that means hand out tax cuts for the very wealthy. That means don't tax the drillers. That means leave that laundering system open so that the money, the profits from big corporations can flow out of the state of Pennsylvania into that little P.O. box there in Delaware, and you and I, the taxpayers here of Pennsylvania, we get to make up the difference. And at the end of this whole budget fight, I don't care what you think, your property taxes are going up because of this. And when they do, you got to know who to turn to. And I say you turn to Sam Smith and Mike Terzai and all of the other Republicans who are pushing this spending plan, which, again, is just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. They've taken a little bit from over here, and they've moved it over here so they can say, oh, well, you know, we care about education. There's still massive cuts. And simultaneously, they're still pursuing that insane SB1. Because we got to have those lottery tickets. We need the vouchers. So what do you think? Where is this going to take us? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to talk with Scott Conklin, state representative. And I got to tell you know, I loved the speeches. Conklin gave a great speech today. Some of our other friends were giving passion pleas to the Republicans to, hey, there's money out there. Revenues are up. Let's use that. Let's not save it. We don't need a rainy day fund when it is pouring, which I think is a valid point. And if you remember, and I thought it kind of ironic that at a certain point I kept hearing people talking about, we need to return the rainy day fund back to the people of Pennsylvania. It was almost the same argument that was used years ago, on the rainy day fund. When it wasn't raining, which I find kind of interesting that the Republicans wanted to give it back to the people when we didn't need it. Now that we need it, now that the state is talking about slashing really major programs, now we should save up a little bit. It's just plain dumb. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. General Electric is trying to eliminate pensions for all newly hired workers, add huge health care costs to its 15,000 union workers, and eliminate the option for early retirements. GE famously paid no taxes last year, and its CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, is actually President Obama's jobs czar.
Never mind that GE has been busily exporting U.S. jobs for years. Monday, about 500 workers rallied at GE in Lynn, Massachusetts for a solidarity informational picket about the upcoming GE attack on middle-class wages and benefits. IUE CWA Local 201 President Jeff Crosby.
Why should a company that ships jobs overseas, pays no federal income taxes, and made $11.6 billion last year now have any right or any cause to try to go after decent living made by the U.S. workers who made them rich? That's the basic question that we have to decide, and I hope that people will see our side of that, and I think they will.
100 days after the historic Wisconsin labor protests erupted in Madison, the effort to gut public worker collective bargaining remains stymied. Jesse Russell reports.
Today is day 100 since the first mass action against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker took place at the Capitol building in Madison. What followed were days upon days of protests, starting at a couple thousand on February 14th and building to more than 100,000 on March 12th. The debate and fight tore the state in two, often putting friends and families at odds with one another. What triggered the mass protests was the so-called budget repair bill that stripped collective bargaining rights from workers. The workers tried to offer the governor fiscal concessions, but he refused to negotiate. In late February, he said if the bill wasn't passed, he'd need to lay off more than 1,500 public workers. After the bill was signed into law, he rescinded those layoff notices. But today, the bill remains tied up in courts and is still not active. The bill is currently under a temporary restraining order due to Republicans allegedly violating open meeting laws. Dane County Circuit Judge Marianne Sumi told the GOP they could get around the restraining order and costly delays by reconvening and passing the bill with proper notice. Republican leaders have said they'll wait until June to see what happens in the courts, but if they don't have movement, they may consider adding it to the biennial state budget. Until then, protesters will likely continue to gather at the Capitol.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. You can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think of this budget? Is this, these kind of massive draconian cuts taking us backwards, is this the way we need to go? Personally, we're going to cut it on the state level, and you know what's going to happen. You know what's going to trickle down to the local level, where you're going to see less services and higher taxes as well. You know, we've already started to see in some areas tax rates going up. We've already seen the push towards raising some of those. Districts are going to be held, especially school districts, are going to be held hostage to the tax man. And do we want to have a system? You know, look, do we want to have an education system that, like, what I benefited from, the ability to play sports, to be in extracurricular activities, the ability to participate in functions at the school and not have to dig into your pocket every single time. I mean, because that's where we're going, folks. We're turning towards conservative world, where every time you turn around, you are digging in your pocket. You want your kid to play soccer? Going to cost you money. You want the kid to play baseball? Going to cost you money. You want the kid to walk across the street? Going to cost you money. Yeah, you know, I think about my father-in-law, who lives down in one of the more conservative states of South Carolina. Every time you turn around, because there are no public services really, every time you turn around, you are digging in your pocket. You want to drive across the street? Got to pay a toll. You want to take the trolley across the street? Got to pay a toll. Every time you want something, you got to pay for it. You got to dig into your pocket. And the question is that where we want to go? Do we want to have fire department that you got to pay, a monthly fee to, or a police department that you've got to pay a monthly fee to? You know, is this the direction? And the hope is no. The hope is that we wake up and we realize the way we had it for a short period of time. You know, the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, into the 80s, you know, that was a short period of time in history where, you know what, you weren't always digging in your pocket. And what bothers me is you've got these folks who are pushing this budget, allowing those who are doing pretty well, like the drillers, to shirk their responsibility and putting the burden onto you, putting the burden onto me. That's what worries me in all of this. And you look at all of the things that they're pushing, these budget cuts for education, the cuts to public welfare, the cuts kicking people off of adult basic, you know, right down the line. And I look at Capital Wire, one of the online news services. They reported that Speaker Sam Smith had told reporters that, you know, this massive surplus that they've now come across because they didn't project properly. There's a big pretty good sized surplus in this year's budget. He said, you know what, I could see, you know, turning back some of those massive cuts that Corbett's pushing through. I could see, you know, taking that money and using it for education and, you know what, protecting that tobacco settlement fund to make sure that those folks who need health care get it. You know, instead of just using it for the governor's, what was that called? Liberty Loan Fund, whatever. What was that? That whole scheme that he was trying to make his own little pot of money so that he could hand out to his people. What was that? So, you know, hours after saying that he would do this, he turns around and he tells the members of the House to vote on a series of six recorded votes to advance a budget that does none of the things that he said he could do. Again, you know, just bad policies and bad politics. But, you know, this is who we're dealing with. Anyway, I've got Scott Conklin on the phone. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, anytime Rick tells you to call in, you don't hesitate. You make sure you're on the phone with him.
I appreciate it. You guys had a spirited day today. Congratulations, but still a little too late.
You know, it's been an interesting budget cycle. It starts out with Terzaghi getting up and talking about open government, open communication, and within minutes they're shutting down communications in the House. And it's been that way the whole time. This is a Corbett budget. You can put it however you want it. The spend number of 27.3 is a Corbett budget. And in my way of thinking, the reason I made a motion today that it was unconstitutional is that I believe it does violate the Constitution. I believe it violates it in many ways. One is the Constitution clearly states on the environmental side that it tells us that we have to keep the environment clean. It belongs to the public. They shut it down, but they failed to put $9 million in DEP. We talk about tourism as our number two industry. It went from $37 million to $3 million. We talk about education as a priority, and they cut higher ed 25% for Penn State, Pitt, Lincoln, and Temple, 15% for the state run. They've cut an average of $1 million out of every school district across the board. They talk about, you know, this is stimulus. You know, the stimulus is gone, but for instance, the stimulus is pennies on the dollar of what they're cutting. This budget does not reflect the citizens of Pennsylvania. And to even go further than that is that they talk about this $500 million and this $1 million surplus next year like it's their money. They say this is their money. They say this isn't their money. The people of Pennsylvania paid taxes. They paid this money. Now what they're saying is we're not going to use it to fund schools. And we're going to raise property taxes. This makes everything they've said is an exact opposite to what they're doing. They talk about the people's money, but they keep it. They talk about they're going to lower taxes, but they implement a budget to raise it. This does nothing for the people of Pennsylvania. What this does is go against what everything that they've talked about for years. Tom Corbett did not discuss this in his campaign, and if he did, I don't believe he'd be governor today.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, one of the things that because I was watching a good portion of the proceedings today, and Mike Terzaghi said something that I again caught my ear, and I have to play the clip because. He asks a very pointed question, and I think there's a very pointed answer to. Here's what he said.
What tax do you want to increase? Who are you taking the money from?
What tax do you want to increase? Like, there are no suggestions out there. Like, it's a mystery to him that we're not taxing the drillers, that we're allowing money to flow out of this state being laundered through a P.O. box in Delaware. Just magic. You know, never heard of it before.
Well, you know, when you hear Terry Biden and Governor Corbett use those terms, they're being totally disingenuous to the Pennsylvania public. They're being disingenuous because they say they don't raise taxes. They're either being disingenuous or they have no concept of how government works. And either way, it's a scary fact. If Governor Corbett, and again, Mike Terzai is Governor Corbett's mouthpiece. You can put it any way you want it. He carries the water for the governor. He's his water boy. He does what the governor tells him to do. He listens and he follows orders. That's what he does. And I know I'm being cruel and straightforward, but facts are the
facts.
No,
I can see it. I can see he's your typical yes man.
But if they were telling them, but they're either being disingenuous or they're misinformed on how government works. When you said, and you tell middle class people that you're going to carry the brunt of the government while 84% of the corporations don't pay corporate tax in Pennsylvania, while we give $833 million in tax cuts to the wealthiest in Pennsylvania. And when you say we have passed a balanced budget for the first time, you are being disingenuous or you've been asleep. Pennsylvanians cannot pass an unbalanced budget. So to even make comments like that is absolutely absurd. The whole thing is nothing but a sham, and they actually believe that the citizens of Pennsylvania are uninformed enough or don't pay attention enough that they're going to eat and drink the Kool-Aid that they're putting in front of them. And you know what? I've been statewide. I've talked to the people. I don't think the people are that naive. I think the people understand when it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Yeah. And that's what this budget is. They can paint it any way they want. They can put whatever ribbons on. But at the end of the day, the people of Pennsylvania know that they're holding $1 billion of their tax money next year so they can give away more corporate welfare, why property taxes go through the roof, why school districts simply can't afford to fund, why tuition prices go up, why nursing homes, Medicare have to raise prices or not accept people, why the programs that are necessary to keep this company functioning, and if they understood business at all, they would understand a rising tide lifts all ships, that the way you stimulate economy is not by cutting a budget that lays, is not by trying to cut the unemployment, which I found it interesting, as you know, trying to cut unemployment failed today, that there are enough folks up there that are scared enough for their jobs next year that they understand you cannot take unemployment away from people. But they do not have a sound business practice. They do not have a sound community practice. And if you can't tell, I just left tonight, and it's a little frustrating when I see this type of hypocrisy happening in an institution that I love so much and a state that I care about so much.
Yeah, and you know what would frustrate me, and it is frustrating, that if I were you and I were in your position, the knowledge that there's really nothing that the Democrats can do other than raise the flags and hope that the people in this state call their representatives, and now it's going to focus on the Senate to try and get someone over there to have half a brain and turn back some of this mess. Because, look, at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. We're going to pay higher property tax, we're going to get less service, and we're going to make the very, very wealthy even more wealthier.
Absolutely. And what I really find surprising is that next year's elections start in about 8 months. It totally shocks me that they're actually taking the people of Pennsylvania for granted. They actually believe that the people of Pennsylvania are so asleep at the wheel and so naive that they can do these type of cuts, and they're not going to realize that their property taxes are going up, that their children are no longer in 25 kids per classroom, but they're in 35 kids per classroom, that their local schools are closing because they have to consolidate because they cut the money. And when you really look at this budget, look who's getting hit. The poorest of the school districts are the ones that are getting the biggest hit. The richest school districts are getting the smallest hit. You're absolutely right. We're causing class warfare in a way that I didn't think we would see since before the 60s.
Oh, come on. There's no such thing as class warfare.
I guess you're right. You know, I guess you're right. I shouldn't stoop to the facts. I should just strictly keep it glossed. I mean, even listen to what they say. They say our budget increases funding. Their budget doesn't increase funding. A 25% cut in higher ed is a 25% cut in higher ed. You can twist it any way you want it, but less money is less money. I'm sure that, Rick, if the people listening today, if they said, you know what, we're no longer going to pay you $18 an hour, we're going to pay you $12 an hour. No, wait a minute. We're going to give you a $4 raise. We gave you an extra $4 an hour at $12 an hour. They're going to look at you and say, wait a minute, I'm making $2 less an hour at the end of the day. They really believe the spin they're putting on is going to work, and it's not going to work.
Well, the Scott Perry bill. I had Scott Perry on the program last night talking about House Bill 916, and he really, you know, he really didn't believe his bill was all that great and had basically said this was the business bill. It was the far-out bill. It's a starting point. So, again, you know, putting the goalpost way out on the extreme in the hopes that they get some of their demands and claim victory for the people who wrote the bill, the business community, and still screw people out of a couple of bucks.
And you know what's really frustrating for someone like myself, Rick, they believe this is the way it's done. Why can't we just be honest? Why can't we just say, you know what, we need to sit down, it's been a tough year, we can't give an increase in funding, or we have to cut 5% this year. Why can't we just do that? Why do we have to play this game to where we say we're going to cut 50%, knowing full well we're not going to cut 50%, we're going to cut 25%, but then we try to make ourselves a hero. We actually, you know, Superman is no good without a villain. Batman's no good without the Penguin.
Yep.
These guys actually set themselves up as a villain and a hero in the same year. Look at this budget. They, you know, this has been the most ridiculously bad play I've ever seen in my life. Corbett says, I'm cutting this much. The Republican House comes in and say, no, 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 we're going to save you. We're only going to cut half of what he's going to cut. And it's been an orchestrated bad play. It's like sitting there, and I have kids, and God loves the people that have kids, and I'm going to say something that will probably get me in trouble. But, you know, unless it's your child,
yep,
sitting watching the first grade band concert with the lead trombonist is one of the things that only the parent looks forward
right.
to doing, because everybody else doesn't buy a ticket. Well, you know what? This orchestration, what they've done this year, trying to spin that we're cutting 25% so we can save the surplus for our election year so it looks good, so that we can give corporate welfare to our friends while we take away from senior citizens, is one of the worst plays I've ever seen in my life. And I'm not a parent to any of these people, so I don't have to sit through it.
Well, and again, you know, when Corbett came out with his budget, you were on the program that night, and you basically laid it out. I mean, you were spot on. You give credit where credit is due. You called it, you know, before it was happening. You're right. They set up these crises, and this is what Republicans do a great job of. They set up these crises. They defund programs. They underfund stuff. I mean, look at our pension. Look at the unemployment system. Had we done the right thing right at the very beginning, especially with unemployment, had they indexed it at 50% of the median wage as they had done back in 84 and said it's going to be 50% of the median wage, that's it, we would have no crisis. But then they'd have no reason to go back and want to pull more from it and make it less of a program for working people.
Absolutely. And they're doing it across the board. You know, this is all about we want to get our hands on school funding. And here's something that may shock the listeners. You know, forget the rhetoric what you hear. Pennsylvania is the only state in the nation that has consistently improved test scores over the last few years. We're the only state in the nation that is doing better in reading, writing, and arithmetic over the last few years. Now, if you're a private agency and you want that money, the last thing you want is for the public school to outperform the private schools and do better.
Yep.
So the only way you get that money is to start breaking them down, bust the teachers down, take the funding away from them so they can no longer do the curriculum which they used to. Then you destroy the system. Then you can get control of it. And I'm going to tell you another prediction. There is no way under this administration that you're going to see vouchers over the next couple of years. You're not going to see it because the public schools, contrary to what people want to say, are working in Pennsylvania. But we defund them. We cause them to make larger classrooms. We put more restrictions on them. We begin to cut and villainize our teachers. These people who make $50,000 a year and raise a family, we make those people the villains. In a few years, test scores are going to start dropping again. And in a few years, they're finally going to be able to privatize and get their hands on that public money.
Yep.
And that's what this is about. It's a long-term game for a long-term plan. And that's what this is about. And it's almost to the point, if you can't tell, I'm wound up tonight, but I can see the plan unfolding, and it's so obvious to myself. And it might be because I was raised Republican. It might be because I'm a businessman, and I understand exactly how I would do it if it was going to happen.
Well, you're spot on right. I mean, it's not about now. It's about down the road. These people got a lot of money, so they've got a little time to wait. And it's about tearing things down. And I go back to, you know, Grover Norquist, the guy who is front and center here in Pennsylvania, even though I don't think most people know, it was Norquist's tax pledge that, our corporate governor took, who said, you know, we want to starve the beast. Or as he said, you know, on this clip here.
I want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
I mean, that's their vision of how to deal with government. How to fund it, we starve it, and we drown it.
And the only thing that stands between corporations, and there are a lot of good, honest corporations, we always go through this, but the only thing that stands between, and a lot of people would be crazy, think I'm crazy when I tell them this, but the only thing that stands between them and you working for a dollar a day, and you not having any hospitalization, and you not having any retirement, you not having any Social Security, is government, believe it or not. I'm not a big person that thinks government should do everything in your life, but I'm going to tell you it's the only mechanism in place that works. The reason this country's come so great is because people came here, and people forget history. I love when I hear my colleagues talk about history. You know, the reason this country was created is because people got tired of the oppression of government taking over their lives, where business control government. And you and I have talked about this before. The downfall of every great nation in the world has been overextension of military forces and corruption of government, where their politicians are bought and paid for by corporations. And the only thing that stopped this country from going the way of other countries is the fact that there have been government officials that do not allow this to happen. But if you break it down in the problem, and again, as long as I'm going on, there are people that are voting that actually believe they're doing the right thing.
There's part of me that doesn't believe that believes what you've said. I think Scott Perry last night when he was on the program, there's part of me that thinks he believes that his bill would make Pennsylvania more competitive and it'd be good, you know, good for the state and it'd be a wonderful thing. But I don't know how stealing money away from people who need it to feed their children and put a roof over their head. I don't know how that's a good thing. But he was all in favor of pushing that bill, which was toxic, which was destructive. But he seemed to think, and there's part of me that believes in his heart that he thought it was the right thing, even though I think it's a horrible thing, that he was doing the right thing.
Rick, here comes the problem. You don't have enough people in government today that have been hungry. Look when this government was the greatest. It was after the Great Depression. It was after the greatest generation of World War II. You had a group of people who went into government, the Harry Trumans of the world, that point in history where Roosevelt, these people were hungry. They went to bed without food in their stomach. They came back and they had nothing. So the only thing that, and again, I come from a very lower middle class family. The most important thing to my family and my friends is a handshake and your word.
Right.
And your word is more than money. Your word's more than anything you have. Those people have died off. We have people coming in today that have never been hungry, that have never worked sick in their life, that they had to get up and go to work because they had kids to feed. We don't have those people today. We have folks now that are bought and paid for, or they're taken in and they come from wealth, or they have some PAC decided to spend $5-10 million on their election. They don't even know who these people are, but they've never been hungry. They've never gone to sleep hungry with their stomach. They've never gone to bed so tired at night because their back hurts and because their blisters are bleeding, knowing full well that in 6 hours or 8 hours, they've got to get back up and work 8 to 12 hours again tomorrow because they have a wife and a kid and a mortgage. We don't have those people in elected office today. And they forgot what it's like, that they're, that what they say means something. And I, and to be honest with you, if you want to do a revolution in this country, you need to get those folks back in office. But with the new federal laws and the money put into it, I don't know if we're going to see that.
It's virtually impossible. And, you know, that's why I think it's so important that here in Pennsylvania in the House of Representatives, we've got a guy like you, Scott Conklin, who sees this and understands the importance. Because most people that I meet, most of my friends, they just want to be done with politics. They think that corporations would be fine running things, or they believe in this bizarre notion of liberty and freedom, that has never existed, that, you know, I just want to be free and live in a liberty society. I don't know what that means, but that's the rhetoric that they're shoveling.
It goes back to the old adage of that, again, what I was talking about. Unless you've been down, you don't know how to get up.
Right.
I mean, I know as crazy as that sounds, unless you have been down, you'll never learn how to get up, and you don't know what it takes. And it goes back to that handshake deal again. If, you know, the folks who vote for me because they believe in me. There's no other reason why they do it, because I don't have money. We don't spend a lot of money on our campaigns. I mean, even the lieutenant governor's race, we spent a few thousand dollars, and we beat, you know, the folks with the millions of dollars. It's because you have to put a line in the sand, and you have to decide what you are. And until you make that decision, you cannot be an effective legislator.
So what do you tell people to do? How do we turn this ship around? I mean, because to be honest, and I said this before, you're in a frustrating position because there's really nothing that the Democrats can do without a bunch of help from the Republicans in the House to get anything stopped. And in the Senate, I think it's 30-20. It's 30-20, so you're going to need an awful lot of help there as well. What do we do?
We need to get involved again. We need to get involved again. And believe me, they want you turned off. They don't want you voting. They want you turned off. They want you to believe the rhetoric. We need to get involved again. And what's about to happen across this country is that once the old adage is, once the horse is out, it's out. Once these programs are cut, they're cut. Once things are gone, they're gone. And we're not going to be able to get them back again for a long time to come. We have to, as people, whether, you know, whatever party you are, you have to, as an elected official, remember you can't overextend what you're asking people for and do it. But the other thing that we have to do is we have to get people involved again. We have to get them back at the polls. Last year, you know, and you and I talked about this, I used to get so upset at the people I was running with last year statewide ripping on the Tea Party. And I used to look at them and I would say, listen, you may not like the Tea Party people. You may want to call them names, but they're energized, and that makes them dangerous. We need to become dangerous again, Rick. We need to get our union base to remember, guys, and those, and up my way, guys, those of you I'm talking to you who decided that, you know what, it was posh listening to some talk show, and I know Rick's a talk show, but some right-wing talk show who told me to vote hardcore Republican. You did it. You did it. You've got them talking about right to work. You've got them taking your unemployment away. You've got them raising your school taxes. You've got them cutting your tuition prices. You've got them raising tuition because they've cut the money to it. You did it. And they did it.
Yep.
Now it's time for you to decide, do you want to just get back to the working people, the blue collar again? If that's what the listeners want, they need to get out next year, and they need to back those candidates who are running. They need to work this fall. They need to get commissioners in place that are going to make sure that services are going to stay intact. The next year they got to work on congressmen and legislators that they want to make, and a president that they make sure that understands that the back of this country is unworkable. That's not run by the rich, and it's not run by the folks that have been in the system for years. It's run by the people that work their tails off night and day, and they have to decide those are the ones that are getting out to vote, because you owe who puts you there. And if you get put into office by the blue collar, by the people of lower and modest income, that's who the people you represent, and that's who the people you have to take care of. And that's how you get this country back.
And it's all about picking up the phone, calling your representatives, writing letters to your local newspapers, being involved and being energized, like you said. The one thing that you are right about with the Tea Party folks, as misinformed as they are sometimes, they were energized and they were in people's faces.
Yep, absolutely.
Scott, always great to talk with you. I love having you on the program. Look forward to having you back real soon.
Hey, Rick, it was enjoyable, and thank you for giving me the stress release tonight. I feel so much better. I'll be able to get some sleep now.
There you go. Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin. Thanks so much, brother.
Hey, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Meredith Baker is hardly a household name, but if you have cable television, her work might soon be entering your household. That's because she is one of four members of the Federal Communications Commission who voted in January to approve Comcast's takeover of NBC. Okaying this combine means that, for the first time, a giant cable TV provider will now control its own national TV programming network, an anti-competitive concentration of media power that bodes ill both for consumers and democracy. But Ms. Baker, a Republican and former Bush official, has long been an anti-regulatory corporate ideologue. She even called mergers, quote, consumer-enhancing and job-creating deals, which is the exact opposite of how they really play out. So her vote to let Comcast swallow NBC was no big surprise. But 4 months later, a hickey has popped up on Baker's vote. It turns out that she's now leaving the FCC, and guess where she's going? Yes, to the Washington office of the newly merged Comcast NBC behemoth, where she'll work as a highly paid lobbyist. The New York Times reports that some are criticizing her spin through the government-slash-corporate revolving door as ethically questionable. No, it's not. It's ethically corrupt, no question about it. Even though she has to comply with a 2-year waiting period before lobbying the FCC itself, she's allowed to start lobbying Congress and the rest of the executive branch immediately. The head of Free Press, a media reform group, calls Baker's lucrative merger with the very corporation she helped merge a blatant example of, quote, a so-called public servant cashing in. No wonder the public is so nauseated by business as usual in Washington, where the complete capture of government by industry barely raises any eyebrows. This is Jim Hightower saying, exactly.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got it!
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Boy, he sounded angry. And, you know, I got to be honest, if I were a state representative put in the situation that he's in, with really no chance of changing the course that we're on, no chance of really changing the destruction that's going to happen, I think I'd be frustrated too. I think, Jake, I would be massively frustrated. I'd be angry about it.
I mean, he's not exactly the most cuddly bear you're ever going to meet. And it's almost like they're saying this is the way it's going to be.
I mean, basically just have it rammed down your throat.
Yeah, basically, that's exactly right.
And, you know, you stop and think about House Bill 916, the unemployment, that horrible unemployment bill. How bad, you know, I've been saying it's bad. Most people go, you know, Rick would say that because he's, you know, he's going to stand up for people like him, people who have actually been on unemployment, who've struggled and have seen how hard it is. You'd expect that from me to say it's a bad bill. But when you have 32 Republicans, 32 of them vote against the bill, you know it's a bad bill. 32. I mean, that to me is just mind-blowing, that 32 of them would vote against it.
Well, I mean, if you have clear things, and there are, you know, we generally favor the Democrats because they generally a little bit more favor labor, but there's some, you know, moderate Republicans out there that are clear thinkers, and they realize that, hey, you know, if these guys lose their money, that hurts the economy of my area. It's that simple, not to mention the fact that it's unjust.
Yeah, you know, and one of the emails I got, you know, I said it was a great segment we had with Scott Perry, and look, you know, I wanted to be civil and you know, not, you know, scream and holler, and I think we accomplished that. The email said he actually sounded reasonable, but how he votes is all that I care about, and his voting record is 100% reactionary.
He might have sounded reasonable, and he was pleasant. However, his reasoning is flawed, as Rick Bloomingdale so aptly pointed out.
Yeah. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, at the end of this, it takes folks like you and me calling them, hounding them, staying on top of them to say, you know, we need to invest in our state. We need to be moving forward instead of doing what they want to do, and that's taking us backward. And then today over at the Capitol, there was a rally in support of a bipartisan House bill, and, you know, there's opportunity there. House Bill 1580, which is sponsored by a Republican representative named Chris Ross of Chester County. This is going to help, again, you know, the SRECs, the solar energy credits, is going to help keep those jobs. It's going to help increase investment in solar power, get us off the juice. And again, you know, it comes back down to smart policy, smart investment. Make sure that you're doing things with public investment that are going to pay dividends. And I think investing in solar energy, I think investing in getting homeowners like me, and in the coming weeks and months, we're going to be talking about my journey through this as the folks that are going to be putting the panels on my house. We're going to have them on. We're going to talk about the process and all of the other stuff. But this bill, and I think Pasquale, who we're going to talk to tomorrow night, he had a similar bill. Which mm-hmm. it's really a very smart job that will create jobs, and it's going to help us get off the oil. And this is where, you know, the Republicans go, well, you know, government doesn't create jobs. Yeah, they do. Smart policy like this helps create jobs. It does. And, you know, dumb things like cutting $1 billion to education and King Granny to the curb, that harms jobs. So again, you know, 916 harming jobs. Taking money away from people who are on unemployment, harming jobs. Because you're not going to have people buying groceries. You're not going to have people paying rent. You're not going to have people paying their utilities. You're going to have problems. Because remember, folks, we are still recovering from the worst economic crisis in generations.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the Obama administration wouldn't have done some things like bail out the auto industry, my God, where would we be?
Yep.
1/7 of the economy, and yet there were Republicans, incredulously.
Sack Wamp.
Who, yeah, Mr. Womp, you know, womp, womp, incredulously, who wanted us to just abandon him.
Let him fail.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, today Google announced it's going to be investing $55 million into California wind energy farm. Again, you know, and this is government money too, because they're going to deduct that from their tax fold. They are increasing their commitment to clean, green energy production. $400 million now Google's going to be into this for. Their director of green business operations, Rick Needham, said the Mojave Desert might be known for its scorching sun and scary sidewinders, but the wind blows hard where the Mojave sand meets the mountains in Southern California, making it a great spot for wind turbines. They're gonna invest with Citibank and a couple other corporations gonna come together and build this TerraGen Power wind farm, lease it back to this company TerraGen to operate. The electricity is going to benefit the people in Southern California. It's gonna power 450,000 homes. Again, you know, this kind of smart investment. And, you know, I look at what's going on in other countries. And, you know, you ever been sitting in front of your computer and you realize that you cannot watch a clip at all? It stops every 2 or 3 seconds. It's because our internet is so bad in this country.
Oh, you must have been reading my mind.
I mean, it drives me nuts.
Oh, it drives me crazy.
You know, when you're watching your porn clips at home, you know.
No, back up. No, be nice. But I.
Right before the money shot.
You know, I'm a big football fan, and I go on college football sites and famous games. You try to watch one, even if it's only a 10-minute clip. That 10-minute clip will take you 15, 16, 17 minutes. It does drive you crazy. Right in the middle of a great play, it stops.
Yeah, well, there's the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Germany. They're working on a new form of using fiber optics to transmit data over a single laser at speeds that dwarf the fastest internet connections. In fact, I'm not one of these techies, but they say that they were able to transfer, they had a transfer rate of 26 terabytes per second. Now, I guess one terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes. That's an awful lot. And what my producer said during the break, the way to put it for the folks who download our podcasts, you may know how long it takes to download just one podcast. It takes a little time, and we appreciate you taking the time for that. But evidently, with this kind of speed, you could download 25,000 of our podcasts in just 1 second. I mean, imagine that kind of speed. I mean, almost 25,000 instantaneously. It also says at this speed, you could download the entire Library of Congress in about 10 seconds.
And you can bet to get that kind of development, the German government was key in that development.
Of course it is. You know, they've invested money into this because they get it. Look, the people who are going to win in the new economy are the ones who can get off the juice, who can do away with the Middle East and do away with all the people who are holding the oil supply. Alternative energy, self-sufficiency, remember that stuff? And the people who can dominate the internet, who have the speed, who have the ability to transfer information quickly.
Think how much money that can save business, Rick. I mean, business time is money. And if it takes you one-tenth of the time that it used to communicate with your suppliers.
Think of how many stock trades on Wall Street you could make in a second. If you could download the entire Library of Congress in 10 seconds, you could make trillions of trades per second. And think of how much money that would make for Wall Street investors. And I say you put a transfer tax on it and make sure we get a portion of every bit of it.
Yeah, but didn't some of that stuff get us in trouble on Wall Street?
Well, yes. That's why I say you put a transfer tax on it to kind of slow it down. And you know what? You build a little pot and you say, well, you transfer all you want. just like the mob card game. You pay the VIG to the house always wins. You play long enough, you lose all your monies in the house. That's the way to go, I think.
But you know Wall Street will fight that to the bitter end.
Of course they will. But here's my problem. You look at this budget. And really, I mean, this budget is really, really bad because it fails to look to the future. It fails to invest beyond the tip of our nose. And while other countries like China are investing in huge wind farms and huge solar banks, while countries like Germany are investing in internet technology and all of these places are on tracking, we're saying, well, the free market will take care of it. And they're not, because the free market is searching for profit. Because we're okay with the crappy speeds that we get on the internet. We don't seem to be all that upset. We may complain to each other, but we still purchase the same programs. I mean, I look at the internet service that I have in the studio here. We pay $200 a month for it. I don't know that's all that much faster than what I have anywhere else at certain times. So, you know, again, you know, you stop and you think about all the investment elsewhere. And we're just not doing it. We're benefiting those who are doing all right. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jason Leopold. Stick around.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. General Electric is trying to eliminate pensions for all newly hired workers add huge health care costs to its 15,000 union workers, and eliminate the option for early retirements. GE famously paid no taxes last year, and its CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, is actually President Obama's jobs czar. Never mind that GE has been busily exporting U.S. jobs for years. Monday, about 500 workers rallied at GE in Lynn, Massachusetts for a solidarity informational picket about the upcoming GE attack on middle-class wages and benefits. IUECWA Local 201 President Jeff Crosby.
Why should a company that ships jobs overseas, pays no federal income taxes, and made $11.6 billion last year now have any right or any cause to try to go after decent living made by the U.S. workers who made them rich? That's the basic question that we have to decide, and I hope that people will see our side of that, and I think they will.
100 days after the historic Wisconsin labor protests erupted in Madison, the effort to gut public worker collective bargaining remains stymied. Jesse Russell reports.
Today is day 100 since the first mass action against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker took place at the Capitol building in Madison. What followed were days upon days of protests, starting at a couple thousand on February 14th and building to more than 100,000 on March 12th. The debate and fight tore the state in two, often putting friends and families at odds with one another. What triggered the mass protests was the so-called budget repair bill that stripped collective bargaining rights from workers. The workers tried to offer the governor fiscal concessions, but he refused to negotiate. In late February, he said if the bill wasn't passed, he'd need to lay off more than 1,500 public workers. After the bill was signed into law, he rescinded those layoff notices. But today, the bill remains tied up in courts and is still not active. The bill is currently under a temporary restraining order due to Republicans allegedly violating open meeting laws. Dane County Circuit Judge Marianne Sumi told the GOP they could get around the restraining order and costly delays by reconvening and passing the bill with proper notice. Republican leaders have said they'll wait until June to see what happens in the courts, but if they don't have movement, they may consider adding it to the biennial state budget. Until then, protesters will likely continue to gather at the Capitol.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a living. Rich and poverty. Father, son, left a cameo. Blue denim, head as big. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, for too many years now, we've been seeing story after tragic story of our young men and women who have served this country being left in the dark. And, you know, I remember the very first thing I said when George W. Bush got us into this war scheme. My very first thought was, I hope that we treat this generation of sufferers better than we did in the past. I hope to never again see the treatment of our soldiers that I saw with my own two eyes as a poor kid growing up in a housing project as the soldiers from Vietnam were being dumped back into our community. And sadly, more and more, it appears as though we haven't learned the lessons of the past, and we haven't learned anything. Recently, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals released a scathing decision, an indictment, really, regarding years of unchecked incompetence at the Department of Veterans Affairs, saying the VA was directly responsible for an epidemic of suicides and the failure to treat PTSD. And over at Truthout, they've got an excellent piece, Court Demands Mental Health Care Reform for Veterans, cites VA's unchecked incompetence by Jason Leopold. I'm here on the line to talk about the piece. Jason, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, Rick.
You know, again, this is a great piece over at Truth Out, and I encourage everyone to go take a look at it. There's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jason's name. Take you right there. So this Ninth Circuit decision has come down, really an indictment of the Bush and Obama policies regarding our veterans. My question is, why is it taking so long to get this right? I think there was enough outrage. There was enough fury. I've been screaming about it. Why can't we take care of these folks?
You know, it seems like such a simple thing to do. Take care of the soldiers that we send off to war. Make sure that they get the medical attention that they need when they get home. Unfortunately, you know, the Bush administration was just unprepared for the number of PTSD cases that resulted from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But in addition to that, you know, the Bush administration truly, just did an unbelievable disservice to our nation's veterans. And, you know, they cut the VA's budget. They cut programs. We all recall what happened at Walter Reed Hospital. You know, veterans who were coming back after multiple deployments from Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Iraq in the first, you know, couple of years, actually, that seemed to be much worse because that's where all the resources were shifted. You know, they sought treatment for, you know, PTSD, but in many cases they were turned away. You had you did not have enough mental health care workers at the VA that knew how to handle this. You actually had cases where, you know, the VA, these VA doctors or benefits workers at the Veterans Benefits Administration, which is part of the VA, shredding the forms. I mean, that was part of this lawsuit, by the way, which has really gone on for about 2 years now as a result of the appeals. There was so much that was revealed. So during the course of the lawsuit, what we learned was that 18 veterans a day were either, you know, attempting or committing suicide, many of them from, you know, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. We found out that the VA knew this was happening and that they sought to cover it up. They didn't want the public to know that there truly was an epidemic of suicides. And then, you know, what we found out is that they just were unprepared. They felt that after the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, that there would be at best 4,500 cases of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, you've said unprepared twice, and I guess my question is, were they unprepared, didn't they just care? I mean, there's part of me that thinks they were so brazen that they really didn't care. It's not a matter of being unprepared. Unprepared is, you know, we didn't anticipate it, but we're going to take care of it. Not caring is, hey, we found there's a problem, we're going to take care of it. Here we are, years into this process, and we're still looking at these people that we're calling heroes, people we've put on a pedestal, people we're telling our children are worth emulating. These are the people these are the heroes, and this is how we treat them?
Yeah, it's criminal in its own way. I think that, you know, you make a good point. It's certainly, you know, when you're shredding benefits forms that these veterans are filling out. I suppose you're right that they don't care, because if you cared, you would not be doing those things. You know, but I also think that the preparation, in the sense of what do we do when veterans go and seek help for post-traumatic stress disorder? Like I said, the Bush administration felt that at best there would be 4,500 cases. There have been more than, if I'm not mistaken, I think those who have filed claims have been, you know, more than 500,000 at this point. But over 1 million have, you know, sought. First of all, more than 1 million have gone through the, you know, the wars.
Right.
But they've, you know, more than 500,000 have filed, you know, for claims. So, you know, and unfortunately, this is an issue. This is a story that is completely under the radar. Not enough people are paying attention to it. And the veterans are suffering. They're still suffering. And Obama came in, you know, making some grand promises, ambitious promises, in terms of reforming the Veterans Administration. And one particular important appointment he made was Jin Seki, who, you know, the Vietnam veteran who has actually served under the Bush administration and was fired or, you know, shoved aside because he said that, you know, we would need about 250,000 soldiers in Iraq. So, you know, they put him into place and you know, they promised to streamline, you know, cut the bureaucratic red tape, basically, and streamline the process for getting benefits. It hasn't come soon enough, and they're still dealing with the bureaucracy there. And veterans are suffering. And basically what this decision says is that it was a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that more or less ordered the lower court judge who found that that he could not force the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs to do anything, to make any changes, forces that judge to work with the veterans groups who sued and the Department of Veterans Affairs to quickly make these changes. And you're right, it isn't this you know, this opinion from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, it is truly an indictment. It's very sad what you know, what it states in there.
Yeah, I'm with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Jason Leopold. His piece, "Court Demands Mental Health Care Reforms for Veterans." You can find that over at truthout.org. Again, there's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. The folks over at Truthout do an outstanding job, well worth looking at. One of the things that you point out in your piece is part of the decision where the judge actually writes, when the government harms its veterans by deprivation at issue here, veterans are entitled to turn to the courts for relief. Indeed, our Constitution established an independent judiciary precisely for situations like this, in which the vulnerable group that is being denied its rights by an unrepresentative government has nowhere else to turn. You also, the decision goes on to say, no more critical example exists than when the government fails to afford its injured or wounded veterans their constitutional rights. Wars, including wars of choice, have many costs. Affording our veterans their constitutional rights is a primary one. And I agree. I mean, at the end of this whole decision is, and this is a great decision, what's it going to mean to cleaning things up to get people the care that they need, especially when you've got a Republican-led House who they're not going to spend money on anything?
No, you're right. And, in fact, that Republican-led House, I mean, some members of Republican Party sought to cut the benefits, cut the budget for the Department of Veterans Affairs. Congress does not care. Now, there is a group of people that you can honestly say, Rick, do not care about our veterans. They've simply provided them lip service. And it's going to take a lot of hard work to, you know, again, cut that bureaucratic red tape. It really does remain to be seen what they're going to do and how quickly they're going to do it. But it's very important what this decision noted. This is a constitutional issue. And these veterans, their constitutional rights are more or less being violated by the simple fact that they have not been able to obtain adequate health care when they're at the risk of suicide. It's been, you know, again, just reading through this opinion was very sad because many veterans during the course of this lawsuit have committed suicide. And it wasn't just that they went in, to their rooms or their garages and took their own lives. They actually went to VA facilities. They tried to get help. They were turned away, and they could have been saved. They could have been saved. The court, they actually note that, and I have to tell you that here we are, you know, we're talking about, you know, even under this administration, you know, continuing to wage wars, that is, and but we're not preparing, you know, for the fallout, for how that's going to affect those that are actually going out there, you know, to fight these wars. And I really think that, you know, as I said earlier, that it's Congress, and that's what the lower court noted, by the way, court noted that Congress should be the one to, you know, implement these changes.
Absolutely.
But they just have not done it. And that includes, you know, Democrats have tried to, you know, make some changes. They certainly, you know, and Obama, to his credit, he's increased the budget. He's instituted, you know, various policies that would raise awareness. But again, the, you know, the problem is that when you're sending, you know, when you have 100,000 troops out there in Afghanistan, yet you have 40 mental health care workers for, you know, more or less to treat everyone, that's a big problem. I mean, you're just, you know, we're seeing what the multiple deployments do. And, you know, the problem,
and that's a key point, the multiple deployments. That, see, this is, again, going back to that whole rah-rah nonsense that we went through getting us into this, where we're,
right.
We're going to go without dragging everybody along, saying, you know what, if we're going to do this as a nation, we have to do it, instead of saying, well, these handful of people, let them carry the water.
And, you know, one of the sad realities under the Bush administration is how much they cut, how little they cared for veterans, and how at Bush's, you know, in the very last days of his administration, how he said that he did more for veterans than, you know, any president, presidents before him.
Oh, yeah, more than the GI Bill, more than all that stuff, yeah. That last couple of seconds there in office, never mind the slashing the funding that he did at a time when the need was skyrocketing, never mind that.
Yeah, and, you know, and again, I think what the problem, you know, this sort of trickles down to, we don't see enough stories, or we don't read enough stories, or hear, you know, the realities of what war does to our veterans.
Well, that's because, you know, the nature of a soldier is to be stoic, to be silent, right. to be solid. And I think part of this problem with PTSD is the military culture as well. None of these people want to be seen as weak. And I understand it, but the hope is that we have people in Congress. The hope is that we have people in positions of power that recognize this is a real problem. People are killing themselves. Families are suffering, that they would do something, and they have failed these people.
Yes, that's it. They've completely failed them, and it's continuing. So, you know, the court is ordering these changes and ordering them to be, you know, implemented quickly, and it's just not a topic of conversation. Again, this is a historic lawsuit.
Absolutely.
A historic lawsuit and a historic decision, and for the past couple of weeks, like I said, it's just more or less, you know, completely gone under the radar. So I certainly appreciate, I'm sure the, you know, your listeners as well, is that you're helping raise awareness about this. It is one of the sad realities of, you know, this decade-old war that we've been waging.
And again, the piece is called Court Demands Mental Health Care Reforms for Veterans. Cites VA's unchecked incompetence over at truthout.org, written by Jason Leopold. Again, you can get that from our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jason's name. It'll take you there. Jason, great piece. Thanks for staying up on this. I'm sure we'll be talking again here real soon as this moves forward, and I'm hoping there is going to be some movement very soon.
Yeah, same here, Brett, and I do appreciate you making the time.
Jason, great talking to you. Thanks so much.
You too. Take care.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Meredith Baker is hardly a household name, but if you have cable television, her work might soon be entering your household. That's because she is one of four members of the Federal Communications Commission who voted in January to approve Comcast's takeover of NBC. Okaying this combine means that, for the first time, a giant cable TV provider will now control its own national TV programming network, an anti-competitive concentration of media power that bodes ill both for consumers and democracy. But Ms. Baker, a Republican and former Bush official, has long been an anti-regulatory corporate ideologue. She even called mergers, quote, consumer-enhancing and job-creating deals, which is the exact opposite of how they really play out. So her vote to let Comcast swallow NBC was no big surprise. But 4 months later, a hickey has popped up on Baker's vote. It turns out that she's now leaving the FCC, and guess where she's going? Yes, to the Washington office of the newly merged Comcast NBC behemoth, where she'll work as a highly paid lobbyist. The New York Times reports that some are criticizing her spin through the government-slash-corporate revolving door as ethically questionable. No, it's not. It's ethically corrupt, no question about it. Even though she has to comply with a 2-year waiting period before lobbying the FCC itself, she's allowed to start lobbying Congress and the rest of the executive branch immediately. The head of Free Press, a media reform group, calls Baker's lucrative merger with the very corporation she helped merge a blatant example of, quote, a so-called public servant cashing in. No wonder the public is so nauseated by business as usual in Washington, where the complete capture of government by industry barely raises any eyebrows. This is Jim Hightower saying, exactly.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me. We're gonna make it somehow.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, I go back to that Jason Leopold piece over at Truth Out. This again, you know, has been years in the making. Why are we still talking about this? Why are we still having to fight? Why are these people still having to fight? And the fact that from internal VA memos, the fact that 18 veterans per day took their own lives and more than 1,000 veterans had attempted suicide per month didn't send up any red flag. Action had to happen. I mean, we've had these conversations, Jake, numerous times. We have had this conversation over and over again where I've said, you know, going back to my childhood, those guys who were dumped back into the projects after Vietnam were left like trash. My hope was that we would never see that. And here we are looking at that.
I remember those same days. I remember seeing veterans scruffy, homeless, wearing their army fatigues, wearing, old green pea coats, not in the pea coats, but old green army coats, and basically abandoned. And I remember the numbers in 07, 08, and the Bush administration were 50 a month committing suicide, 50 a month in that 2-year period.
And, you know, I go back, and, you know, we've had talks about universal health care. We've had this talk, and I look at the VA, and the VA used to have a very proud history. I mean, you know, I knew people who, when I lived in Cleveland, that was where they got their health care. They were very happy with it. It was TRICARE was a good thing. What the Bush administration did to it by slashing its funding is one of the reasons that I'm not all that thrilled with the idea of universal government-run care, because it's at the political whims of people like Bush, of people like Cantor, of people like Ryan and Boehner, and I don't know that I want something like that in the hands of people like that.
And you know what? I don't think the Democrats did a good enough job pointing out the fact that the Bush administration actually opposed a bill that would have allocated more money during that period for soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with deep psychological and emotional problems. They opposed it. And yet they sent those men and women in harm's way. You know, how can we not as a nation? How can we not as a nation, if we sent our own troops to fight and die for this country, how can we not take care of them when they come back?
You know, my daughter came home this weekend, went over to the Army Heritage Center for their Armed Forces Day event. And again, what we're doing is we're propping up the idea of war. And look, and I've taken a beating over my stance on the military. I'm not a pro-military guy. I'm a pro-soldier guy. The people who put their boots on the ground and do the fighting and dying, I say you help them with every bit of help. But as an establishment, we've got a history. And I do believe Smedley Butler was right. War makes rich people rich and poor people dead. I do believe that we've created a class of billionaires out of these misadventures. And we've created a class of people who are struggling and dying.
Well, go ahead, Rick.
And at the end of this, we didn't ask the nation to participate. When Bush got us into this, his call to arms was to go shopping. Put a sticker on your car. That was it. That's what we were asked to do. We weren't asked to fund it. We did that on the credit cards. And now you got the Republicans bitching that, oh my goodness, we have to cut debt. Well, where were you when we were running up the credit card going into the sandbox? And now you got people like Cantor saying, oh, gee, you know, those folks in Missouri, we're going to have to find spending cuts to help them. I mean, it's just plain nuts. It's just plain nuts, and it's disgusting that these people are now controlling the process. I mean, it's infuriating. It's just infuriating.
Well, and then when you have ideologically driven administrations like the Bush administration, and with the way... In the last 20, 30 years, it's a disturbing trend where, you know, presidents just basically, you know, and I know the Constitution says it doesn't work this way, they basically decided we're going to war. Oh, sure, I mean, they dragged the Congress along. But how many people in Congress really stood up to the Bush administration? Very, very few.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, you got something on your mind. A good place to do that. Just angering. Some good news, I guess, you know, since I need some good news right now. It turns out the race in the 26th District of New York, Mr. I'm looking for a date on Craigslist with no shirt on, who resigned. That seat, which has not gone to a Democrat, and, well, I don't think I was alive the last time a Democrat was there. A Democrat has won.
That is huge. According to reports I heard last night, Rick, since the 1880s, it's been controlled by the Republicans.
Well, almost as long as you've been alive.
Just about. But that is big. I mean, we laugh about it, but this is big. Hopefully, it's a portent of things to come.
Well, what
the Republicans overplayed their hand.
Yep, it's that Ryan Butt. It's the destruction of Medicare. I mean, even Republicans go, you know what? Whoa, you're taking my Medicare?
Well,
no.
He was trying to finesse it, and I want to see the Republicans finesse this. And they're starting to right away. Well, you see one of your favorite Republicans, and I say that facetiously, Senator Brown from Massachusetts, all of a sudden he's opposed to it.
Because
now, in his state, it would be death.
Oh, absolutely.
In the Republic, you know, the people, as the Republicans like to say, the People's Republic of Massachusetts, to oppose, to favor the Ryan plan would be political death.
I mean, Martha Coakley, I'm not a death penalty fan. I'm not somebody who supports it. But if I were, she would be a starting point just for running the worst, the second worst possible campaign in the.
Oh, that was horrible.
I mean, Honorado's was, well, I don't know.
You mean?
At least Honorado got out there and tried. Well, I don't know.
Well.
He ran a bad campaign, but she ran a worse one, I think.
One of the dumbest things she ever said. I mean, where was she? She held state office, and she actually questioned why Mr. Brown would be out there handing out leaflets at an outside Boston Bruin game. Are you kidding me? Why? Maybe because those blue-collar hockey fans are your base. And she's questioning why you would do that. Of course,
maybe she
didn't do it. That's why she lost. Or maybe there's a lesson to be learned. Duh. Politics 101. You don't go on vacation 3 weeks before the election.
Well, no, she, you're right. She read the
to Florida.
Elections for Dummies written by John Kerry.
Oh, my. She did everything wrong.
She read the John Kerry book.
I mean, she had massive advantages, and she just blew it.
Yeah, anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, hopefully we're going to talk with Abe Amoros, legislative director of the Laborers International Union, about some of the attacks going on in the House. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? Time to let these people learn the lesson.
No, I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
You know, Tennessee Congressman Zach Womp back, you know, before we decided to help the auto industry here in the U.S. Let him fail was his opinion. Let him go under. Because after all, Volkswagen's investing in Tennessee, a right-to-work state with lower wages, lower health care benefits. Again, you know, it's mind-boggling to me. When I hear that clip, it takes me right back to the moment that I first heard it going, this is a U.S. congressman advocating for a foreign corporation to overtake an American corporation solely because they built a plant in his state. So because his state got a couple of jobs that they paid dearly for, understand, they paid dearly for that Volkswagen plant, $1 billion that they gave out in subsidies and welfare and handouts, whatever you want to call it. $1 billion. And they were willing to allow the American car industry to go under. Well, you know what? You know what's happened? Chrysler paid it back. $7.5 billion in loans that they got from the U.S. and Canada, they have now paid back. And their chief executive officer, Sergio Marchionne, he's going to be joining the White House advisor on manufacturing, Ron Blum, in Sterling Heights, Michigan. to proclaim, you know, we did this. And they had buttons that the today's with today's date on it as the payoff date. This is a great thing for them moving forward. Chrysler is going to turn around. Now, look, you know, part of this that upsets me, Fiat, this Italian company, you know, they're going to be marrying up a little bit. So there's some problems I have a little bit there. But the reality is we saved tens of thousands of American jobs.
They added since 115,000, and those are good jobs.
And this is the kind of stuff, again, you know, you go back to Zach Womp, the congressman in Tennessee, the Republican congressman who, you know, basically said, let them fail. You heard the clip. Why should we prop them up? We've got companies like Volkswagen. They're going to invest here in Tennessee.
Well, if you remember, he took it there and said, you know, this is just a payback to the unions by Obama.
Now, interestingly enough, you know, all of the concessions that the unions gave back, and they gave massive, major, enormous concessions. Basically, the baby and the bathwater, and the container and the rag and the soap and everything else. The starting wage there is like $14 an hour.
$14 an hour for the new hirees.
With poor, you know, not the greatest health care and virtually no pension, but they're saving that company. And again, you know, now you can start to say, okay, yes. Chrysler's turning around. They're getting a little more profitable.
That's exactly right.
It's time to share in some of those profits.
And when they turn around and they keep expanding and they make good money, then it's time for the union to say, hey, it's only fair to give us back a little bit of what we gave to you.
But I go back to this idea of sound investment, smart policy. Is it not smart policy to invest in corporations that are going to stay here? I mean, you know, look, I'm not anti-corporate by any means. I am anti-laissez-faire corporate. I'm against the idea of giving them the baby and the bathwater. I say, you know, give them a little soap, maybe a rag every now and again. Help them grow, but keep them in check so they don't grow too powerful to take over, as we've seen companies like GE, as we've seen companies like Microsoft. At some point, bring them back in, which we have done. But this idea that just let them go, let the entire industry. Can you imagine how much deeper in the hole we would be right now at this point had we allowed Chrysler and GM to go under?
Well, that might have been the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, we might have went into a second Great Depression. 1/7 of the economy, that is huge.
But these are the folks that we now have running. We now have running our U.S. House of Representatives. I mean, Womp is one right there with the T-Twizzlers. This idea that, well, just give it away. Let it go. Let it go. The free market. Yet, and this is what gets me. If they truly believe that, I would have some respect for them. If they truly believed in no hands government, whatever happens in corporate America happens, that's their deal, it's their money, it's their investment, whatever. If they truly believed that, I could understand it. But when you look at that situation in Tennessee, that Volkswagen plant, and you look at all of the subsidies, all of the handouts, the welfare that the state of Tennessee gave away, basically our tax dollars, ours, because we send more money to Tennessee than Tennessee sends to Washington. So they're a net gain. When the tax dollars go to Washington, it's divvied out. Their senators, their representatives do a much better job of bringing home the pork. And they bring home money for Volkswagen to build a plant. And, you know, I just can't go along with that idea. It's just, man. And you look at state after state in the South doing this exact thing. I mean, we're killing each other. We're beating each other senseless. And who's winning? Well, the big corporations. Here's some good news. According to the AFP, Bank of America has entered into a preliminary agreement to pay $410 million to clients who accuse them of excessive overdraft fees, according to court documents. The documents were released yesterday by the U.S. District Court in Southern Florida. It said that the class action suit, including some 1 million clients, and that a final approval settlement date would be for November 7th. This goes back to 2009, centered around the fact that the banking giant Bank of America was basically screwing their people. They were manipulating records of debit card transactions in order to get higher fees. What they were doing is they were taking the highest fees first so that they could get down to the bottom, and that 50 cent charge you made then would be an overdraft fee if you made a mistake. This way they could charge three or four instead of just one. So they went back and they had a class action suit. And they sued. And my question I ask, if they're willing to pay back $400 million, how much did they take? How much did they put in their pocket from consumers who got screwed over this? If they're willing to pay $400 million of it back. And then the other part of this, that the other observation I'll make is, you look at that AT&T decision of the Supreme Court not too long ago, basically ending class action suits. You got to wonder how this kind of stuff is going to play in the future. A couple of things to think about. How much of a heist did they get off of us? And will we be able to sue them again in the future? Just amazing to me. Just absolutely remarkable. But again, they get away with this stuff time and time again.
And yet there wasn't a lot of publicity over that case, Rick. That was huge.
It is huge. Not only is it huge, it could play into your employment contracts, taking us back 100 and some years. But, that's where we want to go, I guess. A new report from the Democratic House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, according to Reuters, said that Congress should take steps to limit speculation in oil markets. Well, gee, thanks for coming on board only a couple years too late. They say that has boosted the prices of gas at the pump by up to 30%. Again, we've been saying this for the longest time, that it's these gamblers who are speculating on the price before it gets to our shores. The report, based on data and comments from industry experts, cites comments made by ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson and others that oil should be in the range of $60 to $70 a barrel based on the fundamentals of supply and demand. That whole business model that they keep pushing out there that they seem to believe in that never really works. They say, we don't need regulations, we don't need oversight, the market will take care of itself. Well, what's happened? The speculators have taken over the market. According to the report, addressing excessive speculation offers the single most significant opportunity to reduce the price of gasoline for American consumers. So all we hear from Republicans is, we need to drill, baby, drill! Open up those leases, open up the motion, start punching holes! The report addresses that as well. They said if we did all the things Republicans want to do, if we set up wells everywhere, we just drilled, it would impact the price by about 1% of the global oil supply. About 1%. So when it's $100 a barrel, that would be a dollar, so it would be $99 a barrel instead of the 60 to 70 that Tillerson and the rest of the oil executives think it should be without the speculation. So you decide where you think the best bang for your buck is. Drill, baby, drill, 1%, or rein in Wall Street somewhere around 30%. Think about it for yourself. Rational thought. I'm not going to try and influence those close numbers. I mean, I know they're very close. 1%, 30%. There's close there. What I do find interesting is that, and this is what Reuters is reporting, and it's about time, that the U.S. futures regulator on Tuesday has sued two veteran oil traders and their employers, Arcadia and Paranon Energy, charging that they booked $50 million in profits. How? Well, doing just what we've been talking about. Between January and April of 2008, these two companies booked about $50 million in profits, manipulating the price of oil at the time because they were buying this stuff. Before it got here, they were basically buying up the amount because they knew there was nothing to stop the price from going up. As long as they kept buying it and pushing the price up and pushing it up, it was going to go up. Now, what I thought should have happened, and maybe I'm just being a little radical, but I think there's part of me that thinks we open up the strategic oil reserves just one big time, push the oil down, make those guys lose a whole bunch of money, and stop this. But I don't know that we'll do that. Again, 30% reining in the speculators, 1% drilling. I think we should maybe drill more. What do you think?
No. From what I've been told, Rick, the law of supply and demand really has more of an effect from the international market on us than the domestic market, from what I've been told.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, this is the and really, I mean, it's this whole pressure of the rest of the world depending on as much oil as we do, and us not moving away from it. I mean, you would think, as one of the wealthiest countries in the world, one would just think that you would want to be as independent as possible so that you could maintain that wealth. Yet we've bought into this, well, oil's the best thing. We need gasoline. That's the best thing. So we don't need to invest in anything else. It just seems bizarre to me.
And the sad part about it is, Rick, we have the wherewithal. If we would have done what Jimmy Carter said, think how independent we would be. So, I'm not so sure we would have gone into Iraq.
I know we would.
To protect our oil.
We didn't need to.
We wouldn't have needed to.
And we wouldn't have needed to slap sanctions on Venezuela's state oil giant PDVSA today. Now, granted, there's not much teeth there. Evidently, Venezuela's been selling oil and trading with Iran, so we're gonna slap them on the wrist. But Venezuela's oil company, Citgo, they'll be able to keep sending oil to the U.S. So you take that as you will. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
One place I won't be, I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it happen.
The
man
who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy, through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
That's quite a mouthful right there. Avarice, ignorance, and greed. Incompetence. An awful lot of... He's got it all right there. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Well, Donald has thrown himself kind of in limbo with the 2012 presidential race on the Republican side. He was talking to those three bubbleheads over on Fox, and you know, basically said, "Well, you know, I haven't left." Shut up, sit down.
But he did say he's available for pinch hitting duty.
Yeah,
basically.
Well, somebody ought to pinch hit him, all right. Maybe fix that hairdo. I don't know, but Tim Pawlenty yesterday launched his big presidential bid, saying that, you know, he was going to, you know, vowing the hard truth. You know, the hard truth. We're going to do that. You know, it's time for new leadership. It's time for a new approach. It's time for America's president and anyone who wants to be president to look into the eye and tell the truth. Someone has to say it. Someone has to finally step up and level with the American people. Someone has to lead. And I will, he said. I'll be that guy. So, you know, he got the big bump and everybody, hey, he's our guy. Woo, woo, woo. You open the paper today. Turns out the former Minnesota governor, Tim Pawlenty, who, you know, just yesterday said, I'm the guy. Turns out, according to the Minneapolis City pages, he had pardoned a sex offender in October of 2008.
Uh-oh
is right. I pardoned this guy, Jeremy Giffer. And you're going to hear it. This is the new Willie Horton, I guess. Evidently back in 94, he was arrested and convicted of statutory rape, served 45 days in prison. And somehow, because he married the then 14-year-old girl that he got pregnant, stuck around to raise the child that they had conceived, the state pardoned him. You know, he begged for forgiveness, and, you know, the state board, which Pawlenty was on, along with the Supreme Court of the Minnesota Supreme Court Justice, him, the chief guy there, and the attorney general there in Minnesota, wiped the record clean. Turns out, a couple years, you fast forward, the child that he conceived with the 14-year-old that he went to jail for having sex with, turns out he's been raping her for years, 250 counts. He's, of course, now back in jail. But this is going to be something that is going to hang around Pawlenty's neck. He says, now, you know, had I known that he was going to do this, I would have never pardoned him. Well, duh.
Well, they also, I saw an interview last night, a former Republican governor who did support Obama, you know, truth in advertising, but he said, you know, plenty saying he balanced the budget all those times. He said it was smoke and mirrors, pretty much. He said he really didn't. He really wasn't innovative. He cut programs, he delayed this tax, accelerated this tax. It was smoke and mirrors. And he really didn't, in the true sense of the word, balance the budget. Oh. Now, this is from a Republican who, by the way, he said he appointed his wife. Was it a judgeship? Or was it a state, I don't know. He did appoint his Pawlenty's wife to some, so it's not like they were longtime political enemies.
Yeah, well, you know, you look at this guy, and again, you know, this child molester who Pawlenty pardoned started abusing his own daughter at 9 years old. And you know, again, and I've said this before, I'm not somebody who's big on the idea of the death penalty, but I could see killing him. Especially if it were my daughter. But there you go. There's the Pawlenty side of it. And you know, Pawlenty's already had some problems. One of his campaign people who got all drunk. Wasn't he the guy, public intoxication, vomiting in an Iowa voter's yard, woke up a teenage daughter by banging on... Wasn't that him? Wasn't it his campaign? I'm pretty sure it was. So the Pawlenty campaign,
well,
off to good starts. Off to good starts.
You know, people have been known to get upset by drinking. You know, now, I know you never experienced that, Rick. But
Reuters is reporting another potential. You know, at least the media keeps pushing Chris Christie out as a potential presidential candidate who may name at some point in the future. But according to his approval ratings in New Jersey, I don't know. He might want to get out of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
His approval ratings, only 40% of the Garden State voters have a favorable view of Christie, while 47% do not. So this is according to a Fairleigh Dickinson poll. Kind of interesting. Nearly a third of the poll said Christie, who some Republicans want to run for president, is doing a poor job. An increase of 5% from last month.
Some news reports say that the big boys have been... talking to him and encouraging him. When I say the big boys, I'm talking about the big money people. I'm encouraging him to run. I think I think the Republican base likes him because he's aggressive.
From the beginning?
He's loudmouth.
Yep.
He projects a strong image, but you know what? I can't believe that the American people would be fooled.
From the beginning, I said he would be the perfect Republican presidential candidate. He's everything that the idiot doofus base wants. He's loudmouth. He's aggressive. He's decisive. He'll make a decision, even if it's the wrong one, and he will stay the course. He will do straight down the line what he says he's going to do, even if it's wrong, no matter what. And that, I think, the Republicans, most Republicans that I know, they value that. They yes. value that mindset.
And he's not, in their eyes, a rhino.
Right. He's going to march down the path.
Correct.
And he is not going to waver one bit. And that's what they want.
Pretty much a bully.
They don't want somebody who, you know, to be honest, you look at somebody like Romney, who I think reasonably could be a decent president if you were looking for somebody who really believed in governing. From the Republican point of view, I do think from a point of governing, I think he's the best of the field. Because it's about getting things done. It's about making improvements in people's lives. I do think he would be not bad. I don't think he would be toxic. I don't think he would be George Bush. I don't think he'd be Chris Christie. He's never going to appease the Republican base.
Well, plus I think one thing, again, that Christie has is that projection of strength, which I don't think Romney has. I'm not going to say he's milquetoast, but he just doesn't show that fire that I think some of the Republicans are looking for. In other words, they want somebody to go to war for their cause.
Yeah, even if you're wrong. And again, you know, that's the thing they loved about Bush. He was taking you down the wrong path, but he was sure about it. He knew he was going the wrong way, but he knew he was going that way.
And he was decisive and didn't back off.
No.
You got to give him that, and
I don't like to
give George Bush credit for anything, but in reality, you have to give him credit. He stayed the course. As wrong as he was, he stayed the course.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Iowa is becoming possibly going to become the very first state to criminalize recording sights and sounds at farms. We've seen some of these documentaries, especially I remember the chicken one, where they had the Kentucky Fried Chicken one. I remember where they were taking chickens and they were throwing them against the walls, and they were doing all kind of really just really inhumane and nasty stuff. And someone had undercover recorded this, and some of the practices that have been recorded, and some of the things that have gone on. Well, Iowa, the agribusiness industry there, the farming groups there, they want to make it illegal to record any of those sights and sounds. They're pushing it through their house as we speak. And what's interesting is that the Republican bigwigs, people like Mary Matlin got involved in this, you know, the one that you like, Carville's wife, who said, what are you people, insane? You're going to be the only state in the country that's doing this, making people think that you're doing something wrong. In fact, she wrote that if House File 589 succeeds, it may well single Iowa out as the state with something to hide, which I know can't be the case. I just wonder if they would take the same position on people recording people like that idiot with the pimp suit. And the bad hatchet jobs. Protect business, yes. People, no, not so much. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Robert Craig from Citizens Action Wisconsin. It's been 100 days since the Wisconsin Awakening. We're going to get a report on what's going on there in Wisconsin and the movement towards justice and peace. And see how to take your state back. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Right away, I'm under attack. I might be damn poor, but I always go back. It's time for war. It's time for war. It's time for war. It's time for war.
abuse are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. General Electric is trying to eliminate pensions for all newly hired workers, add huge health care costs to its 15,000 union workers, and eliminate the option for early retirements. GE famously paid no taxes last year, and its CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, is actually President Obama's jobs czar. Never mind that GE has been busily exporting U.S. jobs for years. Monday, about 500 workers rallied at GE in Lynn, Massachusetts for a solidarity informational picket about the upcoming GE attack on middle-class wages and benefits. IUECWA Local 201 President Jeff Crosby.
Why should a company that ships jobs overseas, pays no federal income taxes, and made $11.6 billion last year now have any right or any cause to try to go after decent living made by the U.S. workers who made them rich? That's the basic question that we have to decide. And I hope that people will see our side of that, and I think they will.
100 days after the historic Wisconsin labor protests erupted in Madison, the effort to gut public worker collective bargaining remains stymied. Jesse Russell reports.
Today is day 100 since the first mass action against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker took place at the Capitol building in Madison. What followed were days upon days of protests, starting at a couple thousand on February 14th and building to more than 100,000 on March 12th. The debate and fight tore the state in two, often putting friends and families at odds with one another. What triggered the mass protests was the so-called budget repair bill that stripped collective bargaining rights from workers. The workers tried to offer the governor fiscal concessions, but he refused to negotiate. In late February, he said if the bill wasn't passed, he'd need to lay off more than 1,500 public workers. After the bill was signed into law, he rescinded those layoff notices. But today, the bill remains tied up in courts and is still not active. The bill is currently under a temporary restraining order due to Republicans allegedly violating open meeting laws. Dane County Circuit Judge Marianne Sumi told the GOP they could get around the restraining order and costly delays by reconvening and passing the bill with proper notice. Republican leaders have said they'll wait until June to see what happens in the courts, but if they don't have movement, they may consider adding it to the biennial state budget. Until then, protesters will likely continue to gather at the Capitol.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The right to bargain is the right that's fundamental about power to the people. That's where it should be. It's called justice. It's called democracy. So hear this, Scott Walker, because your time is limited. Let us tell you what your big problem really is. It ain't your nagging, finger wagging, budget deficit. The problem lies with your moral deficit.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, at the 100-day mark of any administration, you look back and you see what accomplishments have been made. You know, when Tom Corporate here, our governor, hit the 100-day mark, we look back at his destruction of adult basic. We look back on you know, basically a lot of the same things that states across this country have done. You know, the massive budget cuts to education, all of that stuff. We stopped to collect. It's now been 100 days since the great Wisconsin awakening, and I wanted to find out what the last 100 days since the awakening has produced in the great state of Wisconsin. And I wanted to talk to the guy who first broke it to us on day two of the Great Awakening, Robert Craig of Citizen Action Wisconsin. CitizenActionWI.org is the website. Robert Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's been 100 days since that Great Awakening, and an amazing 100 days it's been.
Right. I mean, totally shocking, unpredictable. We think the beginning of an opening for a movement that goes well beyond stopping Scott Walker's agenda. But at this point, we are still faced with Scott Walker and his allies in the legislature have complete control of state government and rolling forward with a lot of other things. The collective bargaining is held up in court. but they may jam it into the full state budget within the next couple of weeks. And so, really, it's still a standoff, but they still have control of government.
Now, the key is the recalls that are going on, I understand. Three Republican senators are up for recall. They have the vote. They have the petition signed, sealed. Everything's moving in the right direction there?
Yeah, there are six Republican senators up for recall, and there are three Democratic senators up for recall. To win, we need a net of three. In other words, we need to pick up three. I think we can hold all the Democrats' seats, so the other side will have endless money in order to try to knock off one of the Democrats. It's very easy to see how we win two of those six Republican races against Republican senators. In the other four, they are all Republican districts, so they're fairly close. We need to pick off at least one of those, and there's going to be battlegrounds across the state. July 12th is the first set of recalls, and the backup date that they've set is August 9th if there are legal challenges or any primaries.
Right. You know, I'm thinking of the Randy Hopper, one of the senators who's up for recall, the guy who his own wife signed the recall petition from reports that I've heard, living with his mistress in another place. I don't see how he can win with campaign literature and campaign ads sending people to his hotline number that sounds like this.
Sexy guy, welcome to an exciting new way to go live one-on-one.
Well, we got
to
stop that. That's enough. But, you know, I guess came right off of his own, speed dial there, but that's where he was sending people. I can't even get a response. in reality, that's off of his own thing. Let's talk about the last 100 days. You were one of the first groups who came out and identified the veiled threats that Walker was going to use the National Guard against workers. And I really think is what was the catalyst for this whole movement to rise up and people to stand up.
Well, I mean, something happened on February 11th. When Walker, announced the budget repair bill, it took a couple of days for the protest to start. It was Walker's, approach that they thought they could ram it through within less than a week before there could be anything to block it. And the street protest began. They didn't stop. And as everyone knows, it turned out the Wisconsin Constitution had a provision that said you needed 20 votes in the state Senate in order to pass something that was fiscal in nature. And there were only 19 Republicans. And so, the 14 Democrats leaving the state led to a stalemate, and the protests continued day after day after day, much longer than anyone ever imagined or predicted. And so that's what kicked this off, and this got national, international attention. It's still getting that kind of attention, but we're still divided in the same way. So we're at it's a little bit of a lull at the moment with the collective bargaining attack in court. But what Walker's doing right now, other than trying to defend these recall elections, is to jam through a state budget for the next 2 years that would just make draconian cuts across the board and assume, essentially savings you can get by busting the unions at the local level. And so there we're talking about just huge amounts of cuts in education and health care, other services that Wisconsin's invested in for years. And so the battleground, and by the way, last week they just passed a photo ID bill for voting, which is an attempt to disenfranchise low-income minorities and seniors and people with disabilities. And so just every day, there's another outrage coming out of this administration and this legislature.
You know, here in Pennsylvania, one of the big newspapers out in Pittsburgh, the Tribune Review, said that this whole conservative way of the attacks that you've just laid out somehow had missed Pennsylvania. Yet in our legislature, we have all of the same bills: the voter ID, stripping away the adult basic from people, the right to work legislation, the stripping of collective bargaining. All this stuff is here. Yet we seem to think that it bypassed us. Because it's not out in the public, it's not out in the streets like you guys were.
Well, I mean, it's part of a whole national plan and program, and a lot of the same bills coming through ALEC, which is funded by the Koch brothers, are appearing in every state. And, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, owned by Richard Mellon Scaife, is, of course, part of that, part of that whole conservative infrastructure that's national in scope. Wisconsin was just the first test case, really, and it blew up in their faces to a large degree, just in terms of public opinion and how much the middle class in Wisconsin and nationally saw it as attack on them. So it's gone beyond public employees. So that creates an opening, I think, to build a much stronger progressive movement that actually starts to address the economic anxieties and, frankly, the declining economic opportunity in Wisconsin and the whole country. But we still face an extremely determined, extremely bold opposition that has partial or complete power in a number of states.
Yeah, and it's that kind of organizing that I think has to happen. I say labor has to do it. Community groups like yours, like Citizen Action Wisconsin. I think groups like this have to be at the front of this, organizing people, because that's the only way we're going to fight back against the billionaire class, who has really, as you pointed out, funded a very strong media presence, a very strong front group present. I mean, you look at all these think tanks, all of these euphemistic sounding groups who just sound so wonderful. Americans for Prosperity. Who could be against Prosperity and the American Federation for Children? Who could be against that? Yet here they are, groups that are going to attack the very fiber of our country.
And I think the mask has begun to come off. It came off with Scott Walker, where it was not about just health care and pensions for public employees. They thought they'd bet public employees up for that one, but taking away their rights as workers. With Paul Ryan, also from Wisconsin's budget, right, which essentially ends Medicare and Medicaid as we know it and puts seniors at the mercy of the for-profit insurance industry. This is all very unpopular once people understand it, but they have immense amounts of money to figure out just how to package it, and they will be very bold in trying to ram it through wherever they can. And so, it's the beginning of the fight if we are going to reconstruct something. And I think we need, once we beat back people like Scott Walker, we need a positive vision. We need a vision for the economy that says that everyone deserves access to a family-sustaining job if they want one, and to have the whole focus of state and national policy be that, because that's what people want and need, not the stuff that's being served up by the right-wing counter-establishment.
Yeah. You know, we went out to Wisconsin during the height of the awakening there, to one, see history, and to two, see what was going on and how we bring it back here, because you're right, the organizing is going to have to happen. We're going to have to offer an alternative vision. So I guess my question to you is, you know, as the leader of a group like Citizen Action Wisconsin, what advice would you give someone listening who wants to start a citizens group, who wants to bring their friends and neighbors and coworkers together to affect some change?
I think that it has to be built on issues. And it has to be built on issues that are fundamental to average people. Sometimes on the left, we get too abstract, too theoretical. We're involved in issues that matter to activists, but don't matter very directly, don't hit people in their pocketbook. And we're in a country where we used to have, the largest middle class in world history, immense amount of family-sustaining jobs to a manufacturing base that we have allowed to be gutted over the last 30 years. In many ways, the attack on public employees is simply the next stage. Once you've gutted the industrial unions and the private sector, that's the last bastion of union power. We need to rebuild union power, but we also need to organize people very specifically about a vision of an economy and democracy that works in everyone's interest and creates maximum opportunity and maximum security for people to live free and independent lives. And we're the only ones who have that, can offer that, but we need a very compelling, unified message, and quite frankly, years and years of organizing get to that point, because politicians aren't going to do it. Politicians as a group are a very cautious bunch in general, unless, of course, they're right-wing Republicans where they have a huge movement behind them. So
right.
Scott Walker and Paul Ryan are very bold, but the average politician is not. What creates this change is movement, and politicians will follow what the movement has created, and people are behind it.
And again, it's going to take people to get out and sacrifice. It's going to take people to get out in the streets. And I believe the only reason that you got as much attention out there is that you had 100,000 people out there. You had thousands of people sleeping in the Capitol. We spent a night there on the marble floor. That's the only way things change.
And it was completely unexpected by Walker and all of his national allies that this would happen, that they thought they could get this through before there was any significant protest. And so, and it showed that workers' rights mattered to people, which even our side didn't predict. And I think the reason for that is that people saw it even more broadly. They not only identified with the public employees, they saw it as a broader attack on the middle class and began to see it connected to all the other things that have been going on in this country as far as reduction in economic opportunity and workers' rights. And so I think that was a spark, but you're right. It looked more like the street protests overseas in Europe or in the Middle East than it did the United States here in Wisconsin. And it could start up in a mass form. Right now it's dissipated from the terms of a visible presence at the Capitol. There's a little bit there, but it's in the recall district, right, which is all over the state. You don't see it in one place. But if Scott Walker, which he probably will do, tries to attach the attack on collective bargaining to the state budget and ram it through in a couple of days, I predict that could happen within the next 2 to 3 weeks, and you can expect to see the protests again arise in Madison.
And again, I hope that those, and my last question to you is, you know, as those people left the Capitol, the large crowds, are you seeing that they're active in their communities and really engaging others? Because I think you're right. The movement has to happen, and it has to be from people like you, people like me, average everyday folk.
There is still just an unprecedented level of activism, even though you don't have 20,000 people a day in the state Capitol. I mean, you can get people out to public events by sending out an email or putting it on Facebook, you know, hundreds of people. And there's a lot of activity in these recalls. In fact, these recalls of the six Republican senators were done largely with volunteers. The Republicans had to do it with paid out-of-state canvas firms because their base is not revved up at all, and they had very little activity. So there really is that kind of energy. It's just amazing the reaction even our emails to our members get nowadays versus what they got a year ago. It's just an agitated and mobilized group of people. But we need to keep moving forward because there is every day, you know, another outrage. It's demoralizing to some degree that Walker and his allies in the legislature are still in power. The latest this week was that they're trying to throw $250 million to Wall Street firms and insurance companies for alleged venture capital investment, where the private sector keeps all the money and gets all the fees, and the government puts the money up. A complete boondoggle, but they're just looting state government as long as they have power.
From the business interest, a perfect public-private partnership, where the public takes all the risk, the public puts all the money, and the private interest walks away with all the reward.
Exactly.
Amazing stuff. Robert Craig, I appreciate your time. Citizen Action, Wisconsin, citizenactionwi.org is the website. Thanks so much. Look forward to having you back again.
Thank you. Always enjoy it. Take
all
care.
Right. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Time, so desperate measures we explore. Marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out,
"Where's your government?"
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have put into a cap
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
Radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Meredith Baker is hardly a household name, but if you have cable television, her work might soon be entering your household. That's because she is one of four members of the Federal Communications Commission who voted in January to approve Comcast's takeover of NBC. Okaying this combine means that, for the first time, a giant cable TV provider will now control its own national TV programming network, an anti-competitive concentration of media power that bodes ill both for consumers and democracy. But Ms. Baker, a Republican and former Bush official, has long been an anti-regulatory corporate ideologue. She even called mergers, quote, consumer-enhancing and job-creating deals, which is the exact opposite of how they really play out. So her vote to let Comcast swallow NBC was no big surprise. But 4 months later, a hickey has popped up on Baker's vote. It turns out that she's now leaving the FCC, and guess where she's going? Yes, to the Washington office of a newly merged Comcast NBC behemoth, where she'll work as a highly paid lobbyist. The New York Times reports that some are criticizing her spin through the government-slash-corporate revolving door as ethically questionable. No, it's not. It's ethically corrupt. No question about it. even though she has to comply with a 2-year waiting period before lobbying the FCC itself, she's allowed to start lobbying Congress and the rest of the executive branch immediately. The head of Free Press, a media reform group, calls Baker's lucrative merger with the very corporation she helped merge a blatant example of, quote, a so-called public servant cashing in. No wonder the public is so nauseated by business as usual in Washington, where the complete capture of government by industry barely raises any eyebrows. This is Jim Hightower saying, exactly. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Going to this battle, take my union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery, for this war is one you're bound to lose. You fascists, you're bound to lose.
Oh, yeah, here's some good news. I was looking at the New York Times today. And finally, someone's going to go and get me a big box retailer that will fly the union flag, if you will. UFCW is going after Target in New York. They're trying to organize 5,000 workers at 29 or 27 Target stores in the New York City area. To me, I think that's a start. I would love to see someone go and get me a place where I can go and shop and know that the employees aren't being exploited, know that they're not getting cheated, know that they're not being, screwed over. Like we've seen for so many years, the stories coming out of Walmart and other big box retailers. It would be nice, wouldn't it, Jake, to be able to go someplace and say, you know what, these folks are paid well. They've got benefits. They've got a retirement. This is a family sustaining job. This is where I want to spend my money.
Absolutely. It would be another reason to frequent these stores, just like we used to. And we have to get back to that. We have to vote with our pocketbooks. I think too many Americans have gotten away from that. It's a simple concept. I mean, it not only enhances the economy, the local economy, but it keeps jobs in the United States.
And you know, the thing is, one of the union officials that was interviewed for this article said that Target's wages are only a little bit better than Walmart's, and Walmart's been getting beat up for a long time for having poor wages and poor conditions. And I think, and I would love to see it, and I'm hoping that it starts, and hopefully Target will be one of those places that that doesn't put up the campaigns that we've seen and we've become accustomed to from American employers, these really harsh anti-union campaigns. I think it's a step in the right direction, and I hope it happens. I would love to see that, nothing more. Because, again, like when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, most of the department stores were unionized.
Mm-hmm.
You would
Kroger's.
Go. Kroger still is. I think they've got like 200,000 members still. And if there was one around here, that's where I would shop. But when I was a kid, the grocery stores all had workers who were making reasonable wages. All the little department stores, they all had workers. My grandmother worked at an Uncle Bill's for 27 odd years. And when the place went out of business, thanks to Walmart, she was making $8 an hour. That was 1985. She was making $8 an hour, 6 weeks vacation. She had full health care, medical, dental, vision, all of that. She had sick days, personal days. She had a secure job that paid a reasonable living. I mean, $8 an hour was a decent living back then. You could support yourself and a child if you had to, which many of the women who worked with her did. Today, what are the Walmarts paying today, some 25, 26 years later? Not much more than that. Without the health care, without
bucks,
the vacation.
Expensive. They have health care, but it's expensive. Most of their employees in Walmart can't afford them.
And you know what? Those stores existed on a method of paying those people, still turning a profit and putting out a good product, having a product for sale. Then the Walmarts came in, and you know what happened? We created a class of billionaires. It's called the Walmart family. Where'd all those wages from those workers go? The prices didn't come down. What happened? Their wages came down. And where'd those wages go? To the Walmart family.
Well, when old Sam was here, he was kind of like an icon, and he kind of held up, you know, the Made in America. Well, they went from that, and they segued into this massive corporation that has enough economic leverage to force their suppliers to go to China.
Yeah, but you have
thousands
to understand,
of
look,
them
out. Look, and I hate when you do this. I really do. This deifying Sam Walton, who basically made his bones screwing workers. Cheating them on minimum wage.
Well, I'm telling you his reputation.
They put out the, you know, Made in America stickers on the products that were, and you give him credit for good marketing, but at the end of the day, he was still someone who screwed his workforce. And that's, you know, what infuriates me about the entire entire corporation structure. It was built on the backs of exploiting people.
You're right. I've heard stories where, you know, some of the things he did was at the, shall we say, the encouragement of his wife.
You know, it's exploit people when you can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, instead of having, you know, I think back to the people that my grandmother worked with. And I remember the one woman in particular. She had four kids. She had four kids. One of them had some physical problems. She was by herself, single, able to support four kids, one of them with physical disabilities, with big medical costs, on a retail clerk job, making, you know, $7.50 or $8 an hour at the time, had health care, had some vacation time, had some sick time. Today, how do you think that would work? There were no government handouts then. I mean, there was no help for her through the government. What happened was is we've subsidized corporations. We've allowed them to pay crappy wages and crummy with no benefits, and then we turn around, and maybe this is what's gone wrong in this country. Maybe too many people like me who say, you know, we need government to help those people who are less fortunate. We need to have programs to help the less fortunate. Maybe I'm the wrong one. Maybe it was because there were unions were so strong back then that they demanded better wages, better conditions, and the people who got them demanded them because it wasn't available any other way. Maybe I'm the wrong one. Thought?
Well, I'm not quite sure where you're coming from on that one.
Well, where I'm coming from is we have all these programs. We have Adult Basic. We have CHIP. We have all these healthcare band-aids that get people healthcare, that get their children healthcare. Because employers are not providing this. It's not there in the workforce anymore. Back then, the employers provided health care. They paid a reasonable wage. We didn't have government subsidies to businesses by propping up the fact that there are no health care benefits. There aren't raises anymore, that people can't afford to live on what's being paid now as opposed to back then. Are you following
me?
Yeah,
I am. I am.
So by us pursuing programs that prop up people who are struggling, we have stopped them from pursuing it through organizing, through unionizing, through demanding that they get those benefits, that they get those rights, that they get a reasonable wage, a reasonable benefit. Maybe, just maybe, and I may be wrong, maybe by having a government that is responsive to the needs of their citizens, maybe we have, in essence,
we've lost the moral persuasion. I understand what you're saying. But you can make that case.
You know, maybe, but at the end of it, you know, I think of her with those four kids, a single woman, able to take care of her family, pay for her family, and not get any subsidy from the government, and still make ends meet.
You know, I can remember growing up in the 50s and 60s, and, you know, a lower middle class, and all the fathers went to work, and the mothers stayed home. And the fathers had jobs that were adequate, good-paying jobs. We didn't live high off the hog, but I really didn't want for anything of the basics. And I lived a decent life, a classic blue-collar job, blue-collar upbringing.
Here again, before my children were born, I was hoping to be the one to stay home. So in this new world, maybe the women go off to work and the men get to stay home and be with the kids. I'd be in favor of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are men that do that. There's nothing wrong with that.
You know, I love coaching T-ball. I love doing all that stuff.
A lot of men, a lot of men would, that would be, I don't know.
All that cooking and cleaning stuff, I think, would be
a downfall. Well, I think part of it is ego, that they're the man of the house and they bring in the money. You know, if you're fine with that, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. We're right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
CCU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Warren in front of the hearing today. Some fireworks.
Really quite extraordinary. This is a nasty argument. Representative Patrick McHenry. This is an oversight sub-panel devoted to oversight of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which President Obama's charged her with setting up. There was now a question from lawmakers and some very spirited back and forth with Republicans. So then the panel tries to recess so they could attend floor votes. So Elizabeth Warren gets up to leave. And she was told by McHenry that two more members wanted to question her, including full committee chair Darrell Issa. She said, well, she understood she was free to leave because she had other appointments. And then it went downhill. That was never the pledge, said McHenry. And so she accused them of making repeated changes to the schedule late into the previous day. Congressman, when you asked to change the time four times in the last 12 hours, including waking people up at home last night to change the time again, and then he interrupted, let me be direct with you. I never made a single phone call about this. I never heard you had to leave at 12:15. Congressman, you might want to have a conversation with your staff. And then he refused to recess the hearing. So it goes on and on and on. And Elijah Cummings tries to step in, and it goes on. And he says, she says, we had an agreement. I committed to you based on representatives of your staff. You had no agreement. We had an agreement. You're making this up, Miss Warren.
Basically calling her a liar.
Yes.
Wow. I know they don't like her, but really this? I mean, it just shows kind of how childish and petulant I think they're being over this.
Well, I mean, and then you had over in the Oversight Committee itself, Darrell Issa, the chair of that, there was a very contentious hearing with the Deputy Interior Secretary, which was, and it was all about oil and leasing and things like that. And at one point, Darrell Issa refused to allow this gentleman to reply to a question, shut him up, and said, basically, I'm not going to allow you to reply because you're going to say something, and he used the word bad, and you're under oath, and I'm not going to allow you to say it.
That's great. So you're gonna come and testify, but I'm not gonna allow you to testify.
Yeah, because you're gonna say something bad, and so, you're on the road. I'm not gonna allow it to happen.
Yeah, I don't want you to say something that I don't want you to say. All right.
Because it's going to be a lie. Because you're about to lie to me.
Oh, well.
Yes, no. He was saying you're about to lie to me.
Wow.
He was accusing him of being about to lie.
Jeez.
That's where the conversation was going. He was accusing him of being about to lie under oath.
Well, you know, hey, if he was good, you got to be thankful to ISA for keeping him out of jail then.
Absolutely. So maybe ISA was doing us a favor.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's interesting to see what's going on there. And so a little infighting within the Republicans. I always love this. Roy Blunt, Missouri, kind of going after the party there for funding in Missouri.
Yeah, very gently going after Eric Cantor, the majority leader. Now, Eric Cantor was chief deputy whip when Roy Blunt was the House Majority Whip, so they know each other quite well. And Cantor said that any aid to Missouri for the tornado would likely be offset with other budget cuts. Not having all the details and information that has filtered in from the latest disaster, I can tell you if there is support for a supplemental, it would be accompanied by support for having pay-fors to that supplemental, he said. And I don't think Blunt thought much of that. And he said, we need to prioritize spending, and this needs to be a priority.
Interesting. So you're going to, again, not only are you going to hold the country hostage over the debt ceiling, you're going to hold the people of Missouri hostage for more spending cuts.
Yeah, and just the way he talked about it, I think, ticked off Blunt, who was trying to, you know, not take him to task because he's a member of the same party, and obviously they know each other well. But I think it came across as very distant.
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds bad. That sounds really bad. But I guess, you know, what more would I expect? What more could I expect? Let's talk about Obama. Tomorrow, what's the plan for tomorrow?
Well, he had the state dinner tonight, the Queen at Buckingham Palace. Tomorrow is a big day. There's a full bilateral meeting with Prime Minister Cameron. They'll discuss Afghanistan, counterterrorism, Iran, Libya, the global economy, the Arab Spring, other events in the Middle East, North Africa. So it'll be a lot of issues. The president will discuss some of the ideas he put forward in his speech on the Middle East last week. Libya, of course, they'll talk about. And then they will drop by an event to honor military families. It's being hosted by the First Lady and Mrs. Cameron. And then they're having a press conference jointly. That could be very, very interesting because the British press can be quite hard. And then the president's delivering a speech to the UK Parliament, and they're describing it at the White House as an anchor speech. They say it's a great honor for the president, and he'll be discussing both the alliance between the US and the UK and the interests and values the alliance is rooted in, and the broader transatlantic alliance and that kind of thing. And then he's going to have a state dinner for the Queen and the G8.
Interesting. I understand the president is threatening to veto over some detainee legislation.
Yes, this is quite interesting. And it's sort of belated, but he's urging Congress not to adopt legislation that would reaffirm and arguably expand the authorization for use of military force passed just 3 days after the September 11th terrorist attacks. And they're threatening a veto over Congress's efforts to limit his authority to release Guantanamo prisoners and to transfer war on terror prisoners held by the military to the U.S. for any reason. So that's what they're threatening the veto over.
Interesting.
It's, you know, so basically it's something that they could have issued the veto over some time ago because this has been out there for a while. But now they finally said it.
No, it'll be interesting to see where that takes us. You brought up Libya a second ago, and it's something we've been talking about here for a couple of days, you know, just amongst the group. What's going to happen here? I mean, are we still dropping bombs over there? Are we still involved? What's the word?
They had a huge night of bombing on Sunday night, a little after 1 a.m. Libya time, NATO did. It was the heaviest bombing campaign of the entire offensive. And I thought the timing was very interesting with the president going to, was it Monday night? Well, anyway, he was just on his trip. And they seemed to be trying to shift the balance somehow, and it was bombing Tripoli very near to Gaddafi's compound. They seem to be trying to shift the balance. They don't seem to be able to shift it and to break a stalemate, and that's what they seem to be trying to do.
I'm under the impression that the time is up. Something's got to be done. We've either got to say we're in this or we got to get out of it. Or am I wrong?
They're in it. I think that's where they're saying they are. I don't think they're about to get out. My impression is that they're saying that they're in it. That's my impression.
And in Congress, any word there?
Well, Congress in the House took up debate on Libya tonight. I think it was tonight that's when they were scheduled to do it, because they started discussion of the 2012 Defense Authorization Bill, and Libya was going to be a part of it. And there was going to be some discussion of what to do about what they believe that the president went over the 60 days allowed in the War Powers Act, which expired on Friday.
Right.
And the president has to come to them for authorization, they believe. And the president doesn't believe that he needs to do that. He believes that he's within his powers to continue with the action.
Again, another example of where I don't agree with the president. I think he should have to go to Congress.
But, I think many, many people do.
Again, just my opinion. Victoria Jones, thanks for the update. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, now to find out what we've got going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jim?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. There's an article out of FL-CIO blog, New Hampshire Right to Work. Veto vote is set for this week. The New Hampshire State House will vote tomorrow to sustain, override Governor John Lynch's veto of the so-called Right to Work bill. Earlier this month, the bill passed the state Senate by a veto-proof majority, but fell short of a supermajority in the House, where a close override fight is expected. In a column in the Conrad Monitor on Sunday, New Hampshire Labor Commissioner George Kapadias wrote that the House should do what both Republican and Democratic lawmakers have done for the last 30 years each time Right to Work has been an issue, reject it. Despite claims to the contrary, this legislation is neither pro-business nor pro-worker. It will do nothing to strengthen New Hampshire's economy. It will, in fact, weaken it. I have been Commissioner of Labor for the past 6 years, according to Mr. Kapadias. I have met and worked with over 2,000 business leaders in various capacities. Not once has a business leader in the state told me he or she believed Right to Work should be adopted in the state. Right to Work is wrong for business, wrong for workers, and wrong for New Hampshire. New Hampshire, by the way, has one of the lowest unemployment rates and a stronger economy than most states with so-called Right to Work laws. Also, in states with such Right to Work for less laws, workers on an average have a lower standard of living, bring home less in their paychecks, and go without health insurance more frequently. Right to Work legislation would do nothing but suppress wages, hurt the state economy, and take away basic worker rights, and absolutely should be rejected. Hopefully the governor will stand his ground on that one, Rick.
So hold on. If I got this right, they have a veto-proof majority? Is that what you said?
No.
They had a majority, just not a veto-proof majority.
Right, correct.
Okay, so because I was reading a story today that said that the Republicans were going to take the override vote during the time when the Democrats were having their big fundraising gala, so that most of the Democrats would be away, so that they then could have enough votes to override the veto. Which again, you got to give Republicans credit for trickery and figuring out how to backdoor people. But I just wanted to make sure that
it passed the Senate by a veto-proof majority, but they don't have them in the House, and hopefully he'll stand still. So it sounds like. Can you imagine that? The Republicans playing tricks.
Yeah, I mean, they've got the unemployment rate under control, everything moving in the right direction. Let's screw that up. It sounds like a great plan. Like here in Pennsylvania, we've got better job growth than most of the right-to-work states. Other than Texas, we've created more jobs, yet let's screw that up.
Well, I mean, and they don't let When they talk about right to work, Rick, since we got in the subject quickly, you know, they don't let the facts get in their way. I've heard more than one conservative just flat out say, you know, in right to work states, workers make more. Well, that's just absolutely not true. Anywhere from 15% to 20% workers in unionized states make more. That's just the simple truth. But yet they propagate, you know, it's the old adage that if you tell the lie long enough and loud enough, people will listen to you. Anyway, Representative Ryan's Robin Hood in reverse budget. What would it do exactly to America? Listen to these numbers. A typical 65-year-old would spend about $6,359 more per year out of pocket by the year 2022 because of Medicare's promise would be replaced with the underfunded vouchers. At least 15 million U.S. residents would lose Medicaid. $4.12 trillion. Let me repeat that. $4.12 trillion in new tax cuts would be handed out, mostly to corporations and the rich. Here's who would really pay for the House Republican budget. Low and medium income Americans, the bill would force at least 15 million Americans off of Medicaid nationally. Our seniors, health care costs for seniors in Medicare would more than double because costs are simply shifted to seniors instead of being cut. Our children, funding for elementary and secondary schools would be slashed by about 25% nationally, Rick. That's astounding. Our college students would be hurt. More than 8 million would lose federal assistance, and they need that. Many of them need that to pay for their schooling. Our workers, a budget estimated to kill between 1.7 million and 2.2 million jobs. As Robert Grinstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities puts it, the Ryan plan would produce the largest redistribution of income from the bottom to the top in modern U.S. history, while increasing poverty and inequity more than any measure in recent times and possibly in the nation's history. And that is saying a lot.
Wow.
One other item quickly. Out of the Harrisburg Patriot, Harrisburg Act 47 plan coordinator is talking with the county, talking with the county hierarchy and with the city people about a possible sales tax. The plan coordinator for Harrisburg State appointed Act 47 has said upon meetings with Governor Corbett's staff today, they were discussing options for Harrisburg's $310 million debt. According to sources, former House Speaker Robert O'Donnell, who in fact was a Democrat, was set to discuss with state officials a sales tax. Let me repeat that. Sales tax for Dauphin County as part of the debt solution for the incinerator debt. O'Donnell was expected to carry a pretty searing message. Without a sales tax, and this is a quote, without a sales tax, which would take state legislator turned out, it's more likely that Harrisburg might have to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. O'Donnell and the Act 47 team, appointed by the State Department of Community and Economic Development, must deliver their plan for Harrisburg by June 25th. O'Donnell has said the exact configuration of the plan remains to be seen, but the inclusion of the countywide sales tax underscores the message O'Donnell delivered to the Harrisburg City Council earlier this month when he said the sale of city assets alone would not alleviate the massive debt guarantee. Act 47 team members cautioned that the sale of city assets would wipe out revenue streams necessary for the city's future operations. In a final statement, he said this, "When we confront this decision, there will be a plan. The hard plan is having to carry it out. Period. Some tough decisions are going to have to be made in the next few weeks, which will have a major, major impact in the future of Harrisburg, and I just hope that they can make those decisions and have this city survive. I don't know about that. Say that's going to be a hard pill to swallow, Rick.
No, we shall see. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
spot back to America. Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Pull out a good old union that's coming here to drill. Which side are you on?
Right, that's a good question. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to the website and download our podcast. And if you were in Germany, if you were at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology there in Germany, you could download 25,000 of our podcasts in 1 second. Because here again, you know, they're investing in the next generation of technology. They're investing in tomorrow. As where we have politicians here in the state of Pennsylvania, in Washington, who are looking at the here and now. Only me, right here, now, my. You know, which, you know, again, is, you know, what you'd expect from a petulant 2-year-old Republican, or child, Republican child, interchangeable, of course. And again, you know, you hear someone like Terzai who says, what do you want? What taxes do you want? What taxes do you want?
What tax do you want to increase? Who are you taking the money from?
Well, again, like I said, you know, a sane, rational extraction tax of the natural gas that's under our feet that belongs to the citizens of this state would be a good start. Maybe closing that loophole that allows all that money to flee the state that every other state in the country seems to say we want to partake in. It's ours. Combined reporting may be a good idea. Good start. And, you know, I guess I don't want to take money from the mouths of children and from granny in the nursing home. I guess I don't want to do that. I would prefer to take it from people like the drilling industry that's making massive profit. I think that's a good place to start. And then I found this clip by Speaker Sam Smith. Just amazing.
At the risk of sounding encouraging, we'll have had 74 different members speak on this bill today. I'm declaring that a record. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. Somebody ought to disprove it.
Whether it's true or not. Again, they have let out a secret. The secret being, I'm going to put it out there. Whether it's true or not, I don't really care about. You figure that out. We're just going to throw a bunch of crap out there. And it's how they campaign. Basically, the mentality of the Republican campaign machine.
Hope it's some of it sticks.
Hoping nobody checks. You know, throw out a bunch of grandiose, big, stories and hope nobody goes, you're full of it. Oh.
Speak of being full of it, I haven't heard recently where Terzai has gone with his numbers. I mean, he was obviously a little bit deficient in his adding and subtracting, if you remember his original numbers.
No, for him, it's
that's
not
right.
About
they changed it.
It's core
they
functions
it.
Of government.
It's core functions of government after they saw that their numbers really didn't add up.
Well, no, after people found out that they reached around behind them and popped it out of their derriere.
I just heard this week, you know, there's some people up in the hill have crunched the numbers, and it could be as low as between 400,000 and 500,000. Or would it be million? Four or 500 million, yeah.
Which is what we get in
He was projecting 2 billion.
He was projecting. Originally, he was saying greater than 2 billion. Then it was 2 billion. And then the T Twizzler tank over here came up with 1.7 billion. Again, where they got that number from, out of the backside, where most of their heads are. And then it went down from there. And then it became, well, we can't make the argument that it's going to do anything to the budget hole. Let's say it's about something government shouldn't be doing. Even though most people are very happy with the way things are. I know I am.
That issue was decided in the 70s.
Yeah, look, you know, alcohol is an adult beverage. Adults know where to get it. And I want people who are smart enough to go, you know what? Tomorrow is Saturday. We're going to have some friends over. It would be nice to have some drinks. Maybe I'll pick some up and have it available if I need it. I don't want an impulse item. I don't want to go, we drank all the whiskey in the place, and I'd like some more. Let's run on down to the Five and Dime and pick us some up with some Tic Tacs. I just don't think I want that.
No, you used to tell the story when you were growing up, and you were, what, 16, 15?
15, 16. It was right there.
It was like driving up and ordering a Big Mac.
Well, I mean, beer, you could go through the drive-thru and get one single can of cold beer. And they'd hand it to you. Want to open it for you? Pretty much. But, you know, the alcohol, you could get 42-proof alcohol in any convenience store. In fact, you know, and I think the statute of limitations is up. You know, we used to go in and just borrow it. You know, we would, that's a horrible thing. But we used to steal it. I mean, because it was there. Which, you know, I guess, you know, it's 30 years. I think the statute of limitations are up. But, you know, that's what kids do. When it's available, when it's accessible, things like that are going to happen. And that's why I'm in favor of leaving it just the way it is. I know where there are several stores. If I need whatever it is I need, I know where it is. Simple.
Well, stuff. You and I were young once. I know that was me a little bit longer ago than you. But even when I was growing up, you know, when we were young, we had the urge to maybe go out and prove ourselves and go out and go on a hard drinking binge. And even though we were 19, we had ways to get it. I mean, the truth is, unless you put
legal age was 18 when I was a kid.
Well, no, it was 21 when I was.
I just made it. I made it by 3 weeks.
The point is, unless there's adequate safeguards, you're going to have a lot of people drinking who are underage.
Yep.
It's going to lead to more traffic accidents. It's going to lead to more laws being broken involving alcohol. It's just going to be bad for society, period.
And I don't want to be the guy, and I have this kind of luck, and maybe some of you out there have this kind of luck, too. You know, I'll be the guy driving home, and the drunk driver will find me, and I'll be the one that gets killed. And unfortunately, you know, in a lot of these drunk driving accidents, the drunk driver never gets hurt.
In simplest terms, Rick, the system isn't
broke.
Leave
it alone.
Why would you want to fix something that isn't broke?
And we, the taxpayer, are benefiting from it wildly. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests tonight on the program. Of course, our good friend, State Representative Scott Conklin, thanks for his time. Jason Leopold over at Truth Out, an excellent article on the Veterans Administration and the failure of leadership in this country to take care of those heroes and to take care of the people who need help. I mean, again, you know, the Ninth Circuit, hats off to them. You know, contact your representatives. Fight over this. And, of course, Robert Craig from Citizen Action, Wisconsin. Thank you. Thank you for being here. I want to thank Brett, our chief engineer. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming. Beneath the sway, imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.